Live Middleweights Tangle with the UFC's Apex. Some big time fights coming at us live this week from Vegas. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. And just like that, we're back and getting set for UFC Fight Night Vittori versus Cannoneer. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. And listen, this is the 75th anniversary. It is the 75th iteration. It is the Diamond Jubilee of the Apex cards. Wow. And Marvin Vettori, Jared Cannoneer, perfect at the Apex. A combined 6-0 there. And a combined 8 main events in total for these two guys. So no strangers to the 5-round atmosphere. But this is one of those Fight and Apex specials type of cards because 14 total fights, so three more than you had on the pay-per-view last weekend. 7 second times out, so a lot of fighters that you might not recognize. And we also have one UFC debut of the former LFA flyweight champ, Felipe Buenas, who's going to be taking on Paddy Pimblett Light, Zhavka Shumagulov out of Kazakhstan. So a lot for the fight fans to get excited and rally around on this card. And when it comes to ranked fighters, there are but 3. Is the co-main event making any sense?
Not really.
Not really whatsoever, but you have a guy that if you look on the Urban Dictionary under Brick House, that's what Joaquin Silva looks like. So a lot of big time fights on this card and a lot of fights that I know, Matt, you and I are really excited about.
And what I really like about this main event is I liken it a bit to like Dan Ige versus Calvin Kattar. It's two guys who have fought a lot of the fighters in the top 15. And let's be honest, this might be the last chance for Marvin Vettori and Jared Cannoneer to kind of maintain their position in the division, because the loser of this, we know what's going to happen, right? They kind of get relegated to you fight the next up and coming guy. And for Jared Cannoneer, well, he's not a young fighter anymore. Marvin Vettori, he's been around. He has done that. So I think this main event is oddly important because I know the winner might not fight for a main event. They might not fight for, you know, the next title shot, but the winner's fighting for their chance to fight another top 5 opponent. I think that's a really important position to find yourself in.
Or you win and you fight Abbas Magomedov or Ikram Aliskerov. The UFC's matchmaking. It's very strange, but a lot of big-time fights to go over. We have a lot to talk about. That much is true. You can find us on Apple Podcasts as well as Spotify. The videos are always here on YouTube. Question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. A final opportunity to look at the week that was and offer up those final picks and predictions. So make sure you check us out all there. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Light heavyweight always needs new contenders, and coming at you in the mix from Vegas this weekend, we have a returning and resurgent the Baltic Gladiator. It's Modestus Bukauskas taking on Ultimate Fighter finalist Zach Paunga. And when you do look at this fight overall, I mean, it's really strange matchmaking to start off a card this way when Zach Paunga's last time out won in a co-main event slot.
Exactly.
And Modestus Bukauskas was the curtain jerker to a pay-per-view card, beating the hometown guy in Tyson Pedro as a massive underdog. And that's kind of been the redemption arc for Modestus Bukauskas. He comes into the UFC, he's all fire and fury, Cage Warriors light heavyweight champ, finishing everybody left, right, and center, a karate black belt, a Gintis combat system black belt. His dad is Gintis, or Gintis, Gintis Bukauskas. He has a black belt under his dad's combat system. Matt, that's kind of like slam! Omar Morales getting a black belt in his dad's system. That's kind of strange.
I'm thinking more like Del Curry, Steph Curry type stuff.
Well, maybe. But for Bukauskas, a really interesting striker. He has that crazy debut against Andreas Mihailidis where he finishes him in the 5th minute of the 5 minutes in the first round. And then somebody pulls the pin on the door and Andreas kind of flops around like a fish, like a bass. But when you look at it for Bukauskas, he went on a bit of a losing streak and it was a little chintzy at times. Now, we know that Bukauskas, it was really a lot of flashy striking, and then in his fight against Khalil Roundtree Jr., the oblique kick seemed
that was
like
disgusting.
It could be a career ender. So the flash and flare from Bukauskas, it was snuffed out. We remember him for his fight against Michael Olszewczuk, where the backward pressure but the good volume wasn't able to win it out. And long before Kai Kara-France versus Amir Al-Bazi is one of the worst decisions ever, was Bukauskas versus Olszewczuk.
That's not one of the worst decisions ever. They had close volume. One guy moved forward, one guy moved backwards. I knew you were going to bring this up.
130-27 MMA decision, 16-29-28 Bukauskas.
You thought that Trevin Jones beat Javid Basharat. No one else did.
No, I didn't. But regardless, when you look at this matchup, for Bukauskas, he goes back to Cage Wars after about a year away. He beats the former middleweight champ, Lee Chadwick. He goes into a title fight and gets it done against 39-year-old Chuck Campbell. And it's crazy to see Bukauskas from the fight they had against Campbell, fourth round finish in that one. He's still doing the same things that he did really well on his way up through. The movement's still there. The knee doesn't seem to be compromised. And when he was fighting against Tyson Pedro in the second round, he was able to land that same right hand kind of rushing across that he landed against Campbell to get the knockout win. So Bukauskas riding a wave of success. He had a giant win his last time out against a fringe guy in Tyson Pedro. And now all of a sudden, against a guy like Zach Paunga, who in his own right, I mean, tasted defeat for the first time in his pro career against one Motor Muhammad Usman on the Ultimate Fighter Season 30 in the finale. He wins the first round handily, and then Motor, flipped the switch, put the key in the ignition.
And that's the good thing for Paunga. He did not look good in that UFC debut up in heavyweight, but I feel like he did make a much better version of himself being known in his light heavyweight debut. I know Jordan Wright's not the guy at light heavyweight, but I do think that is an important win. I do think it's an important matchup when you're looking at how does he match up against tall, lanky strikers who can move backwards, will fight in an upright stance. The difference is, of course, Jordan Wright is much more hittable, and normally when he gets hit, the fight's kind of over, whereas Bukauskas is a very comfortable fighter on the back foot, but that really is kind of the issue, right? That's the thing. No matter what you thought the score was of that Oleksiychuk fight, my whole point is he's a guy who is comfortable moving backwards. And if the volume is one for one, who are the judges probably going to go with? They're going to go with the fighter who's moving forwards and landing their own volume. And the thing that Paunga does have going for him is when he's landing his boxing combinations, when he is able to get on the inside, he is able to land for a decent level of volume. He's not just looking for that one big knockout strike, but I do think that's going to be very important for him. If he does just kind of wade in there, throwing those big bombs, looking for the knockout, well, that's when Bukauskas can lead him into some of his bigger straight shots, because I could see a world where Bukauskas uses his movement almost like a weapon without the volume behind it, right? If he does lead Paunga into a big straight shot, it will be a very damaging one, and that's going to be the really important thing in this fight. How does Bukauskas use his movement? Because if he is willing to move around the cage quite a bit, that's going to be a big benefit. If he gets caught up against the cage, though, that's when we could see Paunga having a lot of success.
Well, when we saw Zach Paunga before he made the jump to the Ultimate Fighter, he's 5-0 as an amateur, started his amateur career at 30. He's only 35 right now, so the age might be there, but he's still young in his career. We know him as a former college football player. Was Zach Paunga like Brendan Schaub, noted football player in college, but
Matt Mitrione, perhaps?
When you look at Zach and you consider all of his skills on a page, he really does push that forward pressure. You saw in his fight against Marcus Perez kind of rallying back out of some sticky situations. Perez missed weight in that one, and if you do consider it, Paunga landing the nice body shot, he likes to land that jab to the body and then come up with the right hand. I know Dan Tom with MMA Junkies all over that one, so shouts to Dan right there. But overall, I mean, for both guys, they both have good cardio. Paunga's got the volume. Bukauskas kind of throws with power when he does decide to throw, but Bukauskas sometimes he's waiting, he switches his stances, he moves quite awkwardly for a big guy. He doesn't necessarily move like a small guy as a bigger guy, but he does move quite well in this light heavyweight division. So overall, when you do look at it, it can be a little bit of low volume for Bukauskas. And if you do consider it, when he does go with the blonde Brunson look or the Charles Oliveira look, it doesn't really work out for Modeskas. But when he goes with his natural blonde look, he does tend to win out on fights. If you look at his Instagram now, it seems to be the darker hair. So we'll see if that prevails. But Matt, when you look at a matchup like this, Paunga against Jordan Wright was almost a 3-1 favorite. He is the underdog in the matchup. Bukauskas was the underdog in his last fight against Pedro, and now he's favored to get the win. We have a look at the Tapology votes to see what their fans are thinking on this one. I'm going to say over under on Tapology, 65% Bukauskas.
I'll say over.
Couple of wins in that UFC record. It's way over. 632 total votes, 85% Bukauskas, 61% by decision, 32% by knockout for the 15% that have Paunga, 65% by decision, 32% by knockout. So Matt, it's two guys really trying to make their way up in a division that all of a sudden has Jamahal Hill as the champ and Alex Pereira jumping up to challenge Jan Blachowicz. So some big time fights, but these guys both coming off of wins their last times out. Who is the pick here?
I have a really hard time with this fight because I do think Bukauskas can lead Pauga into a really big power shot on the back foot. But my issue is, if Pauga is slightly outlanding him on the lead foot, is Bukauskas going to go to the grappling? Because I do think that's something that we could see. I do think he's the more likely of the two to try to mix in the wrestling. Because if Pauga is, again, just wading in, not really being cognizant of the takedown attempt, Bukauskas could go underneath and try to land one of those takedown attempts. But I'm going to go with the slight underdog in this one. I think Pauga's going to get on the inside, make it uncomfortable for Bukauskas. He can land that big shot if he is able to time it, but if he is caught kind of on that in-between, I think Pauga's going to be able to land some combinations. So I'll go with the slight underdog in the opener.
I mean, if you do consider it for Bukauskas' last time out, it wasn't much of a fight against Pedro. Pedro slowed round two. Pedro slowed heavily round three. He just looked completely compromised. The cardio wasn't there. Bukauskas was able to land on the outside, and as I said, it was 2:45 in the second round where he lands that big right hand. But that was pretty much it. And for Pauga, if you go back and rewatch that fight that he had against Jordan Wright, it was equally as bad. It was awful.
It wasn't,
I mean,
good.
Pauga presses the action,
he
gets
right, than he did against
pins
him, but
right up against the cage, and that's pretty much all three rounds. So a big win for both guys their last time out. I do like the forward pressure of a guy like Pauga. He did get caught by that big winging left hook that Muhammad Usman was able to throw out there. But going back and watching the tape from Pauga on the way up and through, and looking at Bukauskas, we knew against Nasiglia, when Bukauskas was able to kind of hang on to that belt over with Cage Warriors, the takedown defense wasn't there, but he got back up and he ended up getting the finish. He's got a lot of resolve. I mean, the knee was the only thing that evaded him really terribly in the other loss. But if you look at it for Bukauskas, his other loss that he had that we haven't even mentioned against Jimmy Crute, Crute was tearing that front leg off with the leg kicks and landed that nice hook in tight that dropped Bukauskas. So I will go with Pauga as well. Really eager to see who the fans have throughout the week on this one, because it seems like the public is really with the Lithuanian. Yeah. Modestas Bukauskas, some big time matchups on this card. 14 total. You are not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
And it is a big-time bantamweight clash coming up this weekend. If you like Kakhramonov versus Nurmagomedov, or if you like Tim Elliott versus Tagir Ulanbekov at bantamweight this weekend, you're going to love the determined Dan Argueta taking on the Heat, Ronnie Lawrence. A couple of weak nicknames, but a couple of fiery bantamweights. And I really like this fight. Like, going back and watching the tape got me excited for it, so hopefully I can convey that to you. Because for Dan Argueta, the fans have known him for a bit of a time now. He's trained at Jackson Wink for a very long time. He was kind of a Cub Swanson protege at the same time.
Interpreter as well.
And if you look at it for Argueta on The Ultimate Fighter, he was on season 29 and he faced Ricky Tercios. Was he selected first overall by Brian Ortega on that season? Yes, he was. And if you go back and watch that Dan Argueta fight against Ricky Tercios, and I plead you to watch it. It's one of the best fights you're going to find on The Ultimate Fighter. And I know Stephen Bonner and Forrest Griffin get that crown, but Dan Argueta, Ricky Tercios, in the opening round of the tournament was an absolutely wild fight, because if Argueta gets the first round and the second round's really close, well, those early fights, they're only two rounds. And then it goes to a sudden death one, and Ricky Tercios ends up holding the position and getting the win in that third round. But Argueta, I mean, he is one of those guys, resilient as ever. He goes back to the regional scene, gets three big wins with the LFA, becomes the bantamweight champ over there, and then on incredibly short notice, fights Damon Jackson up a weight class.
Wild.
Gets taken down and held down, but he gets backpacked.
Made a
and then
good care of himself.
He whack-a-moled poor Damon, and Damon was swelled right up. So the control got a win over that backwards volume type of action. Argueta, his last time out against Nick Aguirre, picking up a big-time win, and where Aguirre had some early opportunities, kind of, round two, round three, Argueta steamrolled over 10 minutes of control time in that fight. And Dan Argueta is one of those guys that already he is just 1-2 at the UFC's apex, because a loss to Tercios, a loss to Jackson, and then a win over Aguirre. It'll be interesting to see how Argueta makes out against a guy cut from the same cloth in Ronnie Lawrence, who struggled against Kakhramonov, who's won a heck of a wrestler, a 2019 fourth place Sambo champion. But if you look at it for Lawrence overall, this guy is so takedown heavy. No, you know, stranger to taking the fight down to the mat. And if his opponent pops back up, he's going to rinse and repeat with the takedown. You saw that in the Jose Johnson fight on Contender Series.
And that was wild because it was insane to see Lawrence get out-grappled to that level by Cock Rachmanov his last time out. But Lawrence is one of those fighters. When he can implement his own offensive takedown, he's just so... Active, I should say. He's like a dog on a bone. He's not going to give up on it, and he will shoot for a very high volume of takedowns, and that's what's going to be the interesting thing about this fight. I think there's one version where we get a lot of clinch control and a lot of kind of stuck takedowns. I really do, because both guys are of maybe not equal value with their wrestling, but both guys, like you said, are cut from that same cloth. When they are offensive wrestling, they're going to have a lot of success. When they're defensive wrestling, or when they're defensive grappling, I should say, they can be held in certain positions, but for Argueta, I feel like he gained a ton of stock in his loss against David Jackson. I don't think a lot of people left that fight thinking, oh, Argueta's not going to have some kind of UFC career
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too. With Argueta, you're going to think, okay, he loses to Jackson at featherweight, so he must be a featherweight because it's on your screen. Nick Aguirre came in as a short-notice replacement, so that's why Argueta's last fight was also at featherweight. Not necessarily worried about the weight cut for Argueta to 135 in this one.
No, but he is a good size for this division. And again, all this fight comes down to is who can offensively wrestle to the highest level. I think the activity, again, I side a bit with Lawrence, and I do think that if he is able to get takedowns, he's going to wear on Argueta a little bit. And I do think that volume is going to help him in the matchup. But if Argueta can just be really heavy on top and hold Ronnie Lawrence in some of those positions, I know Cock Rachmanov wasn't able to completely hold Ronnie Lawrence down. Like, he's a squirmy guy off of his back. So that's why I think Ronnie Lawrence is the slight favorite in the matchup. I just think his activity and his ability to keep on working no matter where the position is why a lot of people are siding with him.
And Ronnie Lawrence, you saw again the resolve when he fought Mana Martinez. He gets rocked and wobbled, and then he's rocking and wobbling Mana himself. And if you look at it for Lawrence, he's beaten one of the Dan Argueta types, and there are types. I mean, the name, by size, by stature. He beat Garrett Armfield over with the LFA, and if I could carbon copy fighters and clone them, they're very, very close. Similar in both respects. But if you look at it for Ronnie Lawrence, one thing that he has going against him record-wise is the fact that he beats Jose Johnson on Contender Series, 12 takedowns in that one. He beats Vince Cachero, 8 takedowns in that fight. Then his next time out, he goes on to take on Mana Martinez, 6 takedowns in that one. Then he fights Sayyid Cock Rachmanov and gets taken down many times. Lawrence, in his takedowns, 26 of 33 attempts by the numbers under the Endeavor banner. You can't really say Zuffa anymore. But for Lawrence, of those guys, the wins and the loss to Cock Rachmanov, none of them in the UFC anymore. None of them. Jose Johnson was supposed to make his debut last year. He made a video on it. And then he missed the weight and they decided, nah, we're done with you. So when you look at a matchup like this for Argueta, he can struggle at distance trying to defend strikes. I mean, one of the things for him is he'll wing a lot of power shots to close the gap, and then he likes to really stay heavy on his opponents. He's the type of guy that if Lawrence gets up, he's going to try and snap down a lot. He's going to try and wear and physically impose against guys. And we saw it out of Argueta where he might have slowed down a little bit against Tercio. So you look at his fight for the LFA championship against Silva, he loses the first round, loses the second round, and wins as that fight goes on. So again, Argueta is one of those guys with that five-round experience. Ronnie Lawrence has been with a lot of big promotions in the past. Some Bellator experience to his name as well against a really good level of competition there. But if you look at a fight like this, Lawrence is one of those guys, pepper, pepper, pepper on the outside, switching stances as he will. You look at the odds in the matchup, Lawrence is the slight favorite here. We have a look at the fan vote on Tapology to try and get a gauge of what the fans are thinking. I'm going to say over, under. I think 70% of the fans over, under going with Ronnie Lawrence.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It is over. So 587 total votes, 75% Lawrence, 91% by decision. For the 25% that have Argueta, 79% by decision. And for Argueta, again, on really short notice, he fights Nick Aguirre, who was a very accredited jiu-jitsu player in that fight. He nullified that game. But when it comes to these two squirmy worms, I'm eager to see who's able to win out with their own wrestling, because Argueta, famously, two-time state qualifier in Illinois high school, he went on to wrestle and team captain when he was at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and Ronnie Lawrence, too, with a very, very good wrestling background.
I do favor Ronnie Lawrence ever so slightly. I think a Daniel Argueta can get set positions and have success in some of those spots, but I favor the output of Ronnie Lawrence, be that with his striking and with his offensive takedown output and his ability to get back up to his feet too. I think if Argueta does get a takedown early on in the round, it's not just a death sentence for Ronnie Lawrence. I don't think he's going to hold that position for 4.5, 5 minutes. So again, I favor the activity of Ronnie Lawrence, but I think this could be a really fun fight.
I saw Argueta freeze in some striking exchanges against other guys, once it starts to get rolling downhill. I mean, first round against Tercios, it was Southpaw versus Southpaw. Second round, Ricky's standing there, gets hit, and goes, "F yeah." And that made me excited. I love that fight. Like, it's one of my favorites. But for the weight-cutting issue, Ronnie Lawrence was forced out of a matchup in the UFC due to weight-cutting complications. He kind of cramped up, so they said, when he's supposed to fight Trevin Jones. So unfortunate there. Eager to see both these guys weigh in successfully on Friday so we can make the video for Question Mark Kicks on Saturday. I do ever so slightly have Ronnie Lawrence in the matchup because I think he can pepper enough on the outside, and he's very quick and sturdy in those scrambles. But Argueta, if he's going to get it done, he is that wrestler at 135 pounds. So a big-time matchup at Bantamweight this weekend. Both of us with the heat. A great Sandra Bullock movie. Let us know down below who you have.
Al Pacino movie.
In the matchup. Some big-time fights on this card, including Vettori versus Cannonier in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Meets water coming up this weekend at flyweight. We have the former Octagon champ Teresa Bleda. She's only 21 years old. She's taking on the former LFA flyweight champ Gabriela Fernandez. And when you look at this matchup, Matt, both of these fighters faced oil meets water matchups in their UFC debuts. And why am I saying they're still looking for their UFC win number one? It's because they lost in impressive fashion. And for Teresa Bleda, she had a competitive first round against Natalia Silva. And then in the second round, she started to slow down. And then in the third round, she really slowed down. And she ate that body shot ended up getting finished. And for Gabby Fernandez, her last time out, she took on Canadian war machine Jasmine Jazavizius, who's apparently the heir apparent to the top five. And in that matchup,
like Kurt Angle, it turns out,
Fernandez was one of those fighters that we knew coming into the inside or coming into the UFC, a tricky sidewinder. She's really able to get it done with her striking, very, very technical that way. But for Fernandez, her takedown defense wasn't what got her to the dance.
Sucks.
And it definitely didn't when she fought Jazavizius. So both of these women go back into this matchup, and we've seen Fernandez in fights get taken down in the past, only to threaten with her jiu-jitsu and get good submission wins. And for both of these women, it's crazy to see that Fernandez only 10 pro fights and Teresa Bleda only 7 pro fights. They each have, because that's how it would work, 2 former common opponents that they both beat in Caroline Martins and Edna Oliveira. So some wild stuff right there. Obviously, Bleda is one of those fighters that was on the come up as an amateur fighter, as a pro fighter, started her amateur career at 15 years old, and now just 21.
Insane.
She had that win in the Octagon tournament during the vid, and she was able to get that win over one tricky fighter, Lucia Pudzilova, where takedowns weren't allowed, but Bleda didn't know about that. I don't know, but if you look at it for Bleda, you look at the wins that she had over with Octagon, it really was putting every single ounce of her being into her striking just to get the takedowns. And she is very much a Miranda Maverick type takedown artist of, I'm putting everything I got into the takedown too in order to get the finish. Gabby Fernandez, fine with playing on the outside to then try and threaten with some of those submissions to get back up to her feet at times. Kind of similar to somebody that we had debut not that long ago in Muin Gafurov, where I'm going leg lock just to pop myself back up to the feet or threaten with a triangle. If Fernandez gets it, great. But when I look at a fight like this, it really will be, can Fernandez outlast Bleda and hit her with a big shot? Because Bleda holds her hands really low and walks around with her head right on the center line.
And for Fernandez, she really is going to have to make a lot of use in that position on top, or at least on the feet, because Fernandez is going to be the more high work rate fighter on the outside. And I do think she can make Bleda for some of those amateurist type strikes she does throw, because Bleda's not going to wow you. She's not got your Rodriguez on the outside throwing things you've never seen before. She is, like you say,
Jab right cross.
Exactly, and the right cross is a lot behind it because she's trying to close the distance, get her hands around her opponent. So, for Fernandez, if she's able to outlast for at least moments on the feet and really get the volume on her side, I could see a lot of judges going with her in this matchup, but that's why I have such a hard time with this fight. It really comes down to what are the judges going to look for? Because if Blade does able to get a lot of top control, but no submission, maybe no submission accomplished. If she can threaten with a lot of submissions every round, then that's probably enough for her to secure the rounds in the eyes of the judges. But if it's a lot of top pressure, but a lot of Gabby Fernandez throwing a lot of volume on the feet, then I do think it's going to be a difficult fight to judge by the end of it. And that's why I'm really surprised to see. For Blade Da, she's 21 years old, so hopefully she can keep on making those improvements. Because, look, if you have the volume of Fernandez with the grappling of Blade Da, we're talking about a pretty good fighter at that point. So, it really is water versus oil. If you think Blade Da can accomplish enough with her takedowns and top control, then you do probably think she's going to go out there and win a decision. But if Fernandez can make her work for a lot of those takedowns, I could see her volume striking, especially in that third round, being really difficult for Blade Da to make up for.
And that's it. I mean, for Fernandez, her last time out, Jazz Vizius went 4 of 8 on takedown attempts, but at 11 minutes and 31 seconds of control time, and brutalized her to the point where it was 3-30-26 on the judges' scorecards. For Blade Da, 4-0 as a pro against Brazilian fighters, and then we kind of go into it and we talk about those common opponents. For Blade Da, if you look at it, Edna Oliveira, she beats her by armbar. If you look at it for Fernandez, she kept hitting her to the body. She throws a body kick, Oliveira kind of drops, and then she taps due to the strike. Yeah. So it was wild to see that one. If you look at it for Fernandez, she wins her LFA belt against Carolina Martins, who Blade Da was able to fight and end up beating her by decision. And if you look at it for Blade Da, when she ended up over on the Dana White's Contender Series, she's taking on Nayara Maia, and in that fight, she does win by decision. She dominated pretty well all 15 minutes of the fight. She drops Maia later on in that one. It's a clinch position, knee to the body. Maia drops like a sack of potatoes. And if you do consider it for both of these women, good in the clinch, so I'm eager to see that position in this fight to see, hey, is it going to open up the takedowns of Blade Da? Does it accentuate the striking of either one of these women? Because, again, when you do consider it, it is oil meets water, but there are some in-betweens that you definitely have to watch out for. So if you have a look at this one, Blade Da is favored to get the win. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Matt, surprise to us, there to you. I think the fans are in buy-low mode with Gabby Fernandez.
Probably.
I'm going to say over-under 85% Blade Da.
85's high, but I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It's under. 617 total votes, 83% Blade Da, 89% by decision for the 17% that have Fernandez, 75% by decision. And again, eager to see Blade Da with the cardio, because when you watch her on Contender Series, the commentary team was bullish on her striking, which was weird. She dominated the fight, and she's not necessarily known as a striker. And if you look at it for Fernandez, we just want to see that polished striker that we saw when she was fighting in Brazil and with the LFA in Brazil. So when it comes down to this one, I do have Teresa Blade Da for the fact that I think the takedowns are going to be the difference maker in the fight. But if Fernandez is able to outlast a big storm, she could end up the winner by decision.
I do think Blade Da is going to be able to get enough top control and not work a lot in some of those positions. Though I do think she's going to have to work to get out of some submissions if she is deep in them. But if Blade Da could just be that heavy fighter on top, you don't waste a lot of energy if you're just holding half control or top mount in that top position. So I do agree with you. I have Blade Da in the matchup. But again, if she loses this, what are we going to do? Because she was that hyped up prospect, a very young fighter at that too. And I do think she's going to need experience. So this is a really good matchup for both fighters, I think.
A get right fight at flyweight. Matt, Blade Da looking to go 5-0 against Brazilian fighters in her career. Gabby Fernandez all of a sudden looking back and saying, hey, I beat Yasmin Lucindo by knockout in my pro debut. And Lucindo's now matched up with the thirst trap on the Instagram, Pollyanna Viana. So a big time fight right there, Matt. But both of us in the matchup going with Czechia's own Teresa Blade Da to get the win. Some big time fights on this card, including a co-main event between Joaquim Silva and Armin Tsarukyan. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
This weekend, Kazakhstan's Paddy Pimblett hopeful Zhaga Zhumagulov looks to right the wrong and start a win streak again as he takes on 33-year-old UFC debutant, it's Filipino Felipe Bunes, and when you consider it for the fighter representing Brazil in this matchup, he did just win the LFA Flyweight Championship back in January, a crazy first-round knockout over Yuma Horiuchi, who I thought beat Charles Johnson in a fight for the LFA Flyweight belt not that long ago. So for Bunes, if you consider it, he is a Pitbull Brothers prospect, and he's one of those guys that kind of follows the traveling group, and he goes from Brazil over to the States, training a fight ready, training with Costa, and again, Patricio, Patricky, John Jones, Eric Albarracin, as well as Henry Cejudo, and I think that experience is invaluable, because Bunes is one of those guys that he was brought in to be the Nate Landwehr, but where Nate Landwehr shone, Felipe did not shine. And he fought a good level competition over with ACA and ACB. He beat Mikael Siklander, who a lot of people know and love. He was a Cage Warriors title challenger. He was an M1 Global title challenger. Kind of long in the tooth, and he was 35 when he fought Felipe, but a big win for Felipe in that fight. But the craziest part about it, if you consider it for the fighter out of Brazil in this matchup, it is fight 1 to fight 20, let's say. And I mean, he has only had 19, so this will be fight 20, so it is pretty accurate. He fights the same way in every single one of them. Does he have a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt? Check that box. Is he a Muay Thai fighter? Take a thick black marker and check that box as big as you can, because he stands really high with his hands up and he throws Thai combinations like you love to see it. A great leg kick, a thudding right hand. His hooks are amazing, and when he goes in for a finish, You're going to want to kind of like brace your eyes a little bit, because it is all heck and fury, if I can say that, about Felipe Bunes in this one.
The one thing for Felipe is he's fighting a guy who's the ultimate dark horse's dark horse's dark horse. Like, Zhanga Shumagulov has long been 3 years away from being 3 years away, but I do think at the year or at the age of 34, he has a great chance to win this fight, because what's the great thing about Zhanga Shumagulov? I was thinking about this last night, how it pertains to
you
the lightweight.
You were thinking about Zhanga Shumagulov?
Yes, I was.
Night.
When I was watching Oliveira versus Dariush, I was thinking about Mateusz Gamrot, right? What is Gamrot really good at? Do you know what I think of when I think about Gamrot in the top 15? He's going to beat some guys in the top 15. He's not going to beat guys in the top 15, but he's going to push them to the limits, and we're going to find out things about that fighter that we might not know, right? Because he's that well-rounded. Zhanga Shumagulov is that type of fighter, right? He has a great work rate. He does have good takedowns. He's a guy who's going to really make you work for your win. And that's what I like about Shumagulov. He's not just going to roll over after the first takedown attempt. He's not so bad of a striker that, oh, you're going to go in there and, like, Conor McGregor, Jose Aldo, and just finish the fight immediately. He's going to test you in a lot of different areas of your game. And for Felipe, it's going to be interesting, because like you say, you bring up the Muay Thai, so the striking, you bring up the grappling aspect. Well, Zhalgas is a very, I don't know if talented is the word I should go for, but he is a very active wrestler. When he's able to get his opponent up against the cage, he's going to force the takedown, mix in his striking and his takedown attempts. And for Felipe, if he is caught in that in-between, if he's caught trying to go for big power shots, and I do really like the striking of Felipe when he's able to mix his kicks in with his punches, but when he is a bit of a boxer, when he is caught a bit on the in-between, he does have great power in his hands, but he loads up a lot on those boxing combinations. And I'm not saying Zhanga Shumagulov is going to make him pay for it with the hands, you know, slip a big shot and then knock him out. But Zhalgas is the type of fighter who can duck down for takedowns when you do go for big power shots. And I think this is one of those fights where the work rate of Shumagulov to go with his threat of takedowns is just really unique, because I do think Felipe is going to have a hard time trying to decipher what he has to
and
worry about.
We saw Zhalgas wrestle a lot more when he was with Fight Nights Global and he was a champ over there. And as I said, with Felipe, if you watch him fight, you might want to purse your eyes a little bit and not watch those finishing combinations, because they're so crazy. Ali Bagwatinov sleeps with one eye open when he goes to bed, because Zhalgas beat him twice. That's a former UFC title challenger. Zhalgas also beat Tagir Ulanbekov and Tyson Nam over with Fight Nights Global, but he is ultimately the best 1-5 UFC fighter,
without
the best 14-8 fighter that you know and you love. And put the talk about the various women in his life aside, Zhalgas grew out that hair to fight
ladies in different area codes.
A lot of different fighters his last time out. And he was supposed to get a Brazilian up-and-comers last time in Rafael Esteban. And Esteban struggled to make that weight. So Zhalgas did his hair up for nothing, and then ultimately
had it's a cute look, though. You know, it gives him personality, because that's the thing. Without guys like us on the internet just bringing up the fact that he's one of the great, terrible record fighters in the UFC, you wouldn't know anything about Zhalgas. So good on him for bringing his personality out of
it. Well, we will see how it goes. But for Zhalgas, you know him for this. A leg kick, forward pressure, a left hand to the body, an overhand right that wings. He closed distance. He holds fighters up against the cage, and he wears on them, and he tends to stay pretty fresh when it gets to the third round. Now, for Chagas in the UFC, he loses one of the chintziest decisions against Haliem Paiva. Then he goes out there and he has a really, really tough fight. And we're considering it. He takes on Amir Albazi. A decent showing at the start, but Albazi rallies as it goes on. He beats Jerome Rivera out of the UFC. He then goes on and he fights Manel Kopp and gets finished. He fights Jeff Molina. Most people thought that Jumagulov won that fight. And then he fights Charles Johnson. MMA decisions. 4, 30-27 Jumagulov, 8, 29-28 Jumagulov, 1, 29-28 for Johnson. Jumagulov not the winner there. He briefly retires, and then he decides, no, I gotta give it one more try. I want that 2-5 moniker in the UFC. So Jumagulov back into the dance for Buenos. Again, if you do look at it, he loses those fights with the ACA. He does get the win against Sealander. He comes in a main event opportunity against Jussie Formiga, who was on a 3-fight losing streak. Formiga, at one point in the world, ranked number one in the flyweight division off a win over Deiveson Figueiredo.
For years, it felt like.
Fought Joe B, who was ranked number two, lost that fight, goes on a 3-fight losing streak after time away, fights Felipe Buenos. Formiga misses weight in the matchup, lands really good leg kicks, ends up getting the fight down on the mat, gets a submission win in that one. Then Buenos goes out, fights old Oscar Cruz. And if you want a good Oscar Cruz fight, it's when he fought Roybert Echeverria over with Titan. But in that one, Oscar is, it doesn't matter what the record is or how old he is. It doesn't matter who it is. He's a Chagas type. He's going to give anybody a tough fight. In that one, Buenos is able to shine with the striking. I know it was just a split decision win. The judges scored at 30-27 Buenos, 29-28 Cruz, 30-27 Buenos. I scored at 30-27 Buenos. It was one of the wildest decisions ever. And then Buenos' last time out, he gets that left hook knockout, follows it up with the ground and pound. If you do look at the matchup, Matt, old crafty Chagas favored to get the win. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprised us there to you. Internet sensation Chagas has a fan vote. So I'm going to say over under 67% Chagas.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. And it is slightly over. 544 total votes. 69% Chagas. 86% by decision. For the 31% that have Buenos, it is 75% by decision. And I think Felipe Buenos silences the crowd and gets an odd short notice UFC debut win in this matchup.
I could see that happening, but I think Chagas is going to make him think on the back foot a lot, and I think that's going to be a really difficult matchup to face in your UFC debut. So I do have Chagas Jumagulov. Listen, if his record gets even worse, it is what it is, but I do think his overall work rate is going to be a really difficult hill for Felipe to climb in this one.
For me, it was a fight that Buenos had, even in a loss. It's a majority decision loss, but the loss that he had to Imran Bukuyev in that one, it was a lot of good counter-wrestling and a lot of good jiu-jitsu and grappling on the mat. Second degree Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt is Felipe Buenos. Matt, split on the pick, but eager to hear from the fans on this one. We know that Kazakhstan's Paddy Pimblett has a lot of fans out there. So let us know who you have down below in the comment section. Some big time fights on this card. If you do consider it, the next one on the docket, Hernandez taking on Bandar. So you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Flyweight is in fuego in 2023, and coming up this weekend, a couple of guys looking to restart win streaks. We have VFS Academy's own Carlos Hernandez taking on Psycho Dinyas Bondar, a guy who was able to get it done over at WWFC. And Bondar actually might be a surprise to some people if they didn't watch the videos last week. He got the win at the GA MMA Amateur Championships in 2019 at Bantamweight over Steven Erceg, who just picked up a giant performance bonus decision win over top 10 one David Dvorak in this flyweight division. So Bondar's already got that feather in his cap. And he's one of those guys that I know the record 16-4. I know that GMMA or GAMMA amateur championship took place when both of those guys were already pros, which is weird. But if you do consider it for Bondar, he had good wins against a bad level competition, but somewhat similar to Tainara Lisboa, who debuted against Jessica Rose Clark, you could see how good Bondar was even against that competition. Now, the sad thing for Bondar is he was a big favorite against Malcolm Gordon in his UFC debut. And I don't think a debut could go any worse with an injury than Bonders did against Malcolm Gordon. I won't show the picture.
Tom Aspinall, Curtis Blaydes comes
out. But that
to
wasn't
mind.
A debut fight. So no, it's just... For Dennis Bonder, things went badly. And Bonder has been booked in a couple of different matchups. Now, he lost 2021 due to multiple fight bookings falling out, and some due to injury, some all over the place. He was, earlier on this year, Bonder was supposed to take on Ode Osborne. It wasn't on a Conor McGregor card. It would have been an Ode Osborne card. But Bonder forced out of that matchup. So now, ultimately, he is a year plus removed from that debut against Malcolm Gordon. And I know we were really excited about that debut from Bonder out of Ukraine. For this fight, he was previously training out of Kharkov top team. He's out of Kharkiv, Ukraine. Obviously, the geopolitical situation difficult there. He's training out of Germany for this matchup. You're going to love this. Planet Eater is the gym. That's the Peter Sabata gym. We've seen Dustin Stoisfus out of that gym. Mert Özildirim, who had an interesting fight against Jarno Aaron. So a good gym for Dennis Bonder getting set for this matchup. Going back and watching the tape for both of these guys got me fired up for this fight, so I'm really excited about this one.
And it should be a great matchup. I'm really excited to see Bonder come back and get a matchup like this in his debut. But I do have to say this. Bonder is a guy who relies on his athleticism quite a bit. He's a physical guy. So I do worry a little bit about the knee injury, and I do think that's a fair point to bring up. Just because if he was somebody who was all technique, kind of on the outside, not using his physicality and his wrestling, then I wouldn't worry about it as much. But I do feel like the style with which he fights under is going to be affected by that knee. So hopefully he comes back and everything is good, because the elbow, because again, I just do worry about that in some of those positions. Because how does Bonder like to fight? He's gonna get on the inside, he's gonna go for the legs, and he will go for trips up top too, and that's what he will go for. I do worry about some of those throws, some of those trips, because those are techniques that are going to rely on him to use that mobility, use that physicality. And for Bonder, it is so essentially a part of his game that I worry a little bit. But for Carlos Hernandez, I just want to shift the spotlight to him really quick. He's someone who can make you pay if you are not at your top, and if you are reaching for some of those positions. And that's why I bring it up. If Bonder does feel like he is somewhat limited on the feet because of that injury, like you say, it's been over a year, it's been a long time, we hope everything is okay. Carlos Hernandez is someone who not only can strike moving forwards, but is comfortable moving backwards with some power shots too. And I could see Hernandez making him really pay for moving into those clinch positions, because Bonder is going to have to fight like one half of our main event. What do I always say Marvin Vettori is really good at? He strikes into the clinch and he avoids big power shots. Well, Hernandez is going to make Bonder pay as he does move into the clinch.
Hernandez has much better volume, and similar to a guy like Dennis Bonder, Carlos Hernandez has an equally impressive amateur record. He was an IMMAF world champ going back to 2014, and in his amateur days, he beat Charles and Jose Johnson, so that really is an impressive stat. Again, he picked up a loss in his pro debut, did Carlos Hernandez, won 8 straight, won on Dana White's Contender Series. He was able to get the win over Victor Altamirano by split decision, the former LFA flyweight champ.
And the wrestling defense was the issue there.
And his last time out, Hernandez struggled with the takedown of Alan Nascimento, who was just booked to take on a ranked fighter in Tim Elliott. Now, when I look at a fight like this, Hernandez is one of those guys that if he needs to wrestle, he can wrestle. If he needs to strike, he can strike. And Hernandez is a guy that's going to really string together a lot of good boxing combinations. When you look at a guy like Dennis Bonder, a lot of power shots to close the gap to get the takedown. And going back and watching the tape, Bonder's last win was back in 2020 against now 19-13 Kenan Jafarli. And in that matchup, it's really aggressive. It's a small cage that looked like the UFC's apex cage. And if you consider it, he is much more finish over position. There were some awkward moments where he puts the knee on the chest of Jafarli. The ref's like, what's going on? But yeah, Bonder from minute 1 to minute 15, he's going to be going for the finish now. In that one in the first round, good movement on the feet from Bonder, but at one point he gets pieced up by a 6-punch combo from Jafarli, and then he has to shoot a panic takedown. He gets it down to the mat. He ultimately gets the second round finish by, it was an arm triangle. If you look at it for Bonder too, the craziest part for me, if it's a big cage, if it's a small cage, if it's the Kumite mat that he fought in the rematch against Lam Ambutsumyan, and I'll throw some pictures up there, They're fighting on a flat mat. And I went back and watched Bloodsport here about a month ago, and I couldn't believe the amount of people that they hired as extras to go, is he going to the Kumite? It's going to be the Kumite. It's like they tried to trademark the word Kumite and hope that they could sell it to UFC 4 to get Israel Adesanya to get dancing on that. But when you look at it for Bondar, he's going for a lot of takedowns. He has his opponent against the end of the mat. And at multiple points, his opponent slides off the mat. Even as Bondar is going for a heel hook, they both slide off the mat. So some wild stuff there. But going back and looking at it again, you're going to have to watch out for the kicks of Hernandez, the boxing of Hernandez, the defensive wrestling. It was shown to be an issue against Nascimento, but typically it's not the biggest hurry or worry. But for both of these guys, a lot of experience. And when I look at them both, Hernandez, I see as a guy that could play around on the fringes of the top 15. Bondar could either surprise, or he has a Tim Elliott career that's outside of the top 15. Because at times, Bondar gets hit and he looks like Elliott, kind of springboarding, and then he's got to shoot for takedowns. And like Elliott, he's really good at flowing and scrambling in positions, but I do worry about him facing some of those upper echelon guys. If Bondar fought Brandon Royval, it would not go all that well for him. Now, if we look at this matchup, Bondar opened the underdog. He's still about there. Carlos Hernandez is a slight favorite. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over-under. I think the fan vote's going to be different than the odds. I'm going to say over-under 62.5% Bondar.
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under. And it is the opposite way. So 574 total votes, 66% Hernandez, 90% by decision for the 34% that have Bondar, 45% by submission, 45% by decision. Who do you have in the matchup?
I have a hard time with this fight because I think Bondar can have success with some of those panic takedowns. Like, even if he does get hurt on the feet, if he shoots for the hips of Hernandez and he's able to accomplish the takedown, I could see him being able to kind of counteract and outweigh the activity Hernandez is able to do on the feet. But for Hernandez, it does come down to how does he react to that pressure of Bondar. I'm going to ever so slightly go with Carlos Hernandez in the matchup. I think he is going to be able to land the slightly more damaging shots, be it on the back foot and the front foot. But this is a really difficult fight to predict. And a real sink or swim matchup.
And here, I did make a mistake because in the Jafar Lee fight, it was all Bondar. In the fight that Bondar had against Kewin Jacques, who at the time was 19 years old, that's when he gets hit and hit hard. And he's got a panic for the takedown. He ends up getting the finish. I like Bondar in the matchup. I like the motor compared to a guy like Carlos Hernandez. I think Bondar is really going to push a pace in this one, try and get back some of that time away because, again, his last win was about 3 years ago. So for me, it will be Bondar in the fight, but a big-time matchup in a stacked flyweight division. It will never die. 2018, what was that? I don't remember. Matt, split on this pick. Some big-time matchups on the card. The co-main event. You like scrambles? You like fights? You like Zarukian taking on Silva? You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Couple of bantamweights with a combined 9-1. If you mash it up those five on ins, we have a problema, and it's Christian Quiñones, who wowed on a week and a half's notice in a debut against Khalid Taha's last time out, replacing Taylor Lapolis over in Paris. Quiñones this time looking to turn the page, and he's taking on Mr. Perfect, Kyung Ho Gong. And Matt, when it does come to guys that are under the radar in a stacked bantamweight division, Kyung Ho Gong is that guy. He made his own UFC debut against Alex Caceres in a split decision loss where it was overturned to a no contest because Caceres puffed and passed before that fight, and he was ordered into drug counseling. Matt, way back when, they were some different times. But Matt, if you look at a four guy like Kyung Ho Gong, I mean, large chunks of his career off due to inactivity, 2014 to 2018, mandatory military service. He had a bit of a hiatus, I guess, from 2019 to 2021 due to injuries and a marriage, so kind of happy, kind of sad. But if you look at it for Gong, his last loss, he floors my guy, Ronnie Yahya, in the first round, only to tire and get taken down against the much older Yahya. And then Gong's last time out, and this fight clouds my judgment of the fight that Gong has last time out, clouds my judgment of this fight against Christian Quiñones. Gong, his last time out, did something I've never seen him done in any of the tape study. He goes out there and fights behind a jab and a speedy 1-2 for three rounds against Bakary Dana and has a close striking contest against one of the better, more hyped up strikers that we've seen in some time in Bakary. So for Gong, his last time out, abandons the jiu-jitsu, abandons the takedowns, which really kind of cemented him as a premier guy at bantamweight. And for Quiñones, not known for his takedown defense, though he does have good jiu-jitsu, brother of Teco Quiñones, who fought Sean O'Malley one time and fought in The Ultimate Fighter. But for Christian Quiñones, he gets it done on the feet, and he is a lot of fun to watch when he's standing.
And that's why this is an interesting fight, because it really comes down to how does Kyung Ho Kong want to fight this fight? Because if he does fight with his wrestling and with his jiu-jitsu, it's the path of least resistance, right? Like, I wouldn't strike with Christian Quiñones. I don't think a lot of smart fighters would, because he does have that next level power. The right hand he landed over the top of the guard of Kylie Taha before he knocked him out was absolutely dirty. Like, that was a beautiful shot that did lead to the finish. And if Kyung Ho Kong goes out there and does try to strike, be that cute fighter on the outside, I think it's going to spend or end very poorly for him. But Kong does have all of the skills. That's the thing. He does have the striking. He does have the wrestling. He does have the jiu-jitsu. But at 35 years old, you do wonder, is the time off and kind of all the what-ifs, are they starting to add up? Because at 135, we don't see a lot of fighters at 35 having a ton of success. So you do worry, is the gas tank going to slow down? Because if he does go for a lot of takedowns early in this matchup, you bring up the Jaime Barcelos fight. If he goes for a lot of takedowns early in this If he goes for a lot of takedowns early in this fight and does have success, could he tire himself out if he's not able to get a finish? I think this could be a fight where he wins a lot of battles, but ultimately could lose the war, because if he is not a sitting duck on the feet in the third round, but if he is tired, if his hands are down and he's just walking backwards against a guy like Quiñones is going to find the chin at some point because he's that talented of a striker.
And we've only really seen Gong in a couple of fights struggle with the pace, and it was that Rani Aya fight. He was trying to go for his own takedowns at the same time, and he struggled trying to get wrapped up against a guy who's been in the UFC doing it for a long damn time, Rani Aya. But Gong, I mean, even at home in Busan, he's taking on Liu Pingyuan. It was a wild fight. It was a split decision win for Gong. And in that one, if you look at the end of it, his face and his nose, he looks like the skate guards that guys wear if they're going to block slap shots, or like the toe guards that you wear in baseball. His nose was swallowed right up and flat on his face. So it was a tough look for him, where he got cut open in top position against Liu Pingyuan. If you look at it for Christian Quiñones, I have to say this because, again, I talk about Teco, who is his brother, and Christian is on a 5-fight win streak, but his last loss was against Victor Hugo Madrigal. And Matt, there's a guy, and I'm going to put us at the opening portion of this. There's a guy. This guy keeps the Quiñones brothers awake at night. Victor Hugo Madrigal. He's beaten both those brothers, and they never get their shot to beat him. So Victor Hugo Madrigal, keeping people awake at night. Matt, when you look at a matchup like this, Quiñones, when he is standing, he's an odd striker because he has good leg kicks. He doesn't necessarily throw them a ton. He fights beyond a jab, double up, triple up, which is awesome to see. But he fights with his hands up, and you never really know what's coming. He's not like a TJ Dillashaw where he's throwing that power hand up to try and distract your eyes. He just kind of fights with a really high guard. And he is a guy out of Entram Gym training with some of the fighters that you're also going to have on this card, like Manuel Torres. And both of those guys fought in the same episode of Dana White's Contender Series. Quiñones gets a win over the WLF War's own. It was Zhao. And in that fight, he did look really good. He defends all the takedowns. He's able to piece up his opponent on the feet. He gets that Taha win after an extended period of time off himself. But if you do look at it and you consider it, Quiñones did struggle against Matos with the takedowns, but he ultimately gets the win there. And we can go down through both these guys' extensive records. But if you consider it, I mean, Gong, he's dropped fighters in the UFC. He's been dropped in the UFC. I think it's Taruto Ishihara's fight at UFC 234 is probably the one that a lot of people go back to. That was a wild one round of action. But when we look at this matchup, Matt, for Mr. Perfect, he is the one that's not favored so far. If we have a look at the fan vote on Tapology to try and see what the fans are thinking, I'm going to say over-under for the much younger fighter in this one who's 27. I'm going to say over-under 75% Quiñones.
I think it'll be over.
I think it's going to be over. It's right on. 575 total votes, 75% Quiñones, 68% by decision for the 25% that have Gong, 80% by decision. And for Kyung Ho Gong, his last time out, he took on, again, Bakary Dana, who had just fought Chris Gutierrez. 4,201 total votes, 26% had Gong to get the win. So he wasn't favored by the fans in that one, equally not favored by the fans in this one. Do you have the younger guy, Quiñones, or do you have that old road dog, Kyung Ho Gong?
I've got the younger fighter. I have problema. I just think he's going to make Kong pay a lot more for when he's going for those takedown attempts. I do think Quiñones is going to be able to land some of those awkward angle shots, and you're right. Is what he does all that organic or unique? No, not really. He does fight in an awkward stance, but it does work for him, and and he is able to land pretty good power shots with that right hand. He can set it up well with the left. You bring up the double and the triple jab. He just throws the left hand well to distract the opponent so he can set up the big power shots. So I do have Quiñones in this matchup.
I think Kyung Ho Gong mixes it up and gets the win in this matchup against Quiñones. And Quiñones has good jiu-jitsu that can get him back up to the feet if he needs to. Gong's got the good takedowns. A freestyle wrestling base is what you'll see. Or you'll see takedowns of a freestyle wrestling base from Kyung Ho Gong, who made that UFC debut against Alex Caceres on a fight card headlined by Vanderlei Silva and Brian Stann at the Saitama Super Arena. A wild one indeed. And Matt, for Gong, if you do consider it his last time out, 64% significant strike rate over three rounds against a good striker in Bakary Dana, and he didn't show any signs of slowing down in that one. So I have Kyung Ho Gong in the matchup, Matt. You're going with Christian Quiñones. If Kyung Ho Gong wins by flying triangle like he did against one Guido Canetti,
I would be surprised.
I'm going to lose my damn mind, and Victor Hugo Madrigal gets a shot in the UFC if that happens. Matt, some wild stuff in this matchup. We're split on the pick. Let us know down below what you have in a matchup in the deepest division in all of MMA. Some big time fights on this card, including Vittori versus Cannoneer in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Irene Aldana couldn't get it done for the team against Amanda Nunes, but Alessandro Costa out of Lobo Gym looking for his first UFC win. He's going to try and rally the troops. Nono's got a big time fight coming up against 2020's biggest flyweight story. Won the brick, Jimmy Flick. In 2020 was the last time he won a fight when he took on Cody Durden. He had the flying triangle win, and his last time out after 2 years away from action, he took on Charles Johnson, and the pressure of Johnson ended up earning Johnson the TKO victory. So for Flick, the retirement, it was a surprise. The quotes after the retirement, they were a surprise. Flick, the former LFA flyweight champ, he gets the win on Contender Series by submission. He ends up in the UFC. But yeah, the retirement, short-lived. So Flick looking to get it done in this matchup where both guys good at jiu-jitsu. Both of them black belts. Both of them accredited on the ground. Both guys will strike, but in different ways, because for Alessandro Costa, he's going to throw every ounce of his being into his boxing combinations. He's not a big kicker, whereas Jimmy Flick is all about throwing kicks to all three levels on the outside. Not necessarily known for his boxing. Flick, very, very good with his wrestling. But for Alessandro Costa, a wrestling base to get him into his jiu-jitsu. And Costa's going to go for some very powerful takedowns in his fight. So it'll be interesting to see what we get, because with Costa, where he wasn't as successful as Flick on Contender Series, you might go, Craig, but he won a fight, and he dropped his opponent in that fight. Yeah, he did, but he wasn't Joe Pyfer in week one of last year's Contender Series, so he had to prove himself. Costa goes back with Lux. He gets his flyweight belt back, and then he ends up into the UFC against the now third-ranked Amir Albazi. And it was like going to a small town, just a driving range for Amir Albazi, and he was hitting balls off a tee against Alessandro Costa. He looked really good with his own striking. It was on short notice for Costa, but it was way too much too soon, so a tough test there for Costa. Whereas Flick, he did come back and lose to Johnson, who has lost two in a row after that, so it doesn't necessarily look all that good. But Matt, this is one of those get-right fights for both of these guys, and it should be a lot of fun where both have bases in jiu-jitsu.
It should be a lot of fun, but for Flick, it's going to come down to how does he deal with the pressure of Costa, because if Costa's allowed to throw in the pocket, there's no real consequences for it. I don't know how Flick, with his kicks, is going to be able to create some of that distance, because he's a fighter. Now, Ryan Hall isn't the perfect comparison, but I do think there are some similarities in the way that they will fight on the back foot, try to use their movement, use their opponent's forward pressure to bait them into big strikes, and again, use those kicks like you bring up. And Flick does have good leg kicks. He will throw them to the head as well. But if Costa is able to really assert his dominance and his positioning on the inside, I think he's going to be able to go to the body and the head with his boxing combinations. And I think that's going to be a difficult hill for Flick to climb, because Flick has such a unique game. I think he could win this fight by submission off his back, oddly enough. You don't say that often in MMA, but he is of that level with his grappling. He is that tricky off his back. He's that tricky in the top position as well. I just think that unless he's able to really go out there and dominantly use his offensive wrestling, what is his answer going to be on that in-between and up close? Because if he just goes for the clinch, well, Costa's still going to throw damaging strikes in the clinch. He still has good dirty boxing, and Costa can go for his own takedowns like you bring up. So unless Flick's going to be able to go out there and really put on his wrestling shoes a la Corey Anderson before he gets exciting all of a sudden, I do think Flick's going to really struggle with some of the ranges in this fight.
And it'll be interesting out of both these guys, because for Costa, I said he's not a big kicker. He's not a big leg kicker. But if you watch his fight against Kike Gonzalez for the belt over with Lux, when Costa's able to get the win, what sets up the finishing sequence? It's a kick to the body that sends his opponent running. He ends up getting the fight down to the ground. He finishes it. So a big win for Costa there. He drops Martinetti over on Contender Series with a short right hand in close, drops him like a sack of potatoes. And then Costa's last win, when he's taking on old 6-4. We're talking about Carlos Gomez in that one. What was it? Leg kick, left hand, and then straight right hand. And sleeps his opponent Cargo in that one. So good wins for Costa on the way up, but not against a great level competition. Flick definitely fought a better level competition on his rise. Obviously, Flick is the older fighter in the matchup. He's the bigger fighter, the longer fighter, and he's not the favored fighter in this one. We have a look at the fan vote. Costa finished his last time out, and so was Flick. So the get right fight is in effect. A lot of those on this card. Yeah. So usually produces fireworks, Matt. I think the fans are going to go with Costa. I'm going to say over under 72.5% Costa.
I think it's over.
It is over. 619 total votes, 77% Costa, 80% by knockout. For the 23% that have Flick, 62% by submission. Matt, these two guys, I mean, it's what? 16 wins for Flick, 12 wins for Costa, a combined 20 submission wins out of the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts. And most people think Costa is going to win by knockout. I have Alessandro Costa in this fight. And there was one thing that I heard the corner of Charles Johnson yell over and over and over again in the first round of the fight against Flick. And it was, put him on his heels! Put him on his heels! And it worked for Charles Johnson.
He can't kick moving backwards. Pretty
now,
hard.
Johnson throws a lot of everything. He throws a lot of volume, and it might not hit. Kind of like a Ricky Tercios, whereas Costa likes to rip to the body to come back up to the head. I like that for Costa in this fight, and that's why I'm picking him. You can never count out Flick. We saw it. Contender Series, LFA, and all of the organizations that he fought with on the way up. The triangle chokes, the guillotines. Flick is one of those guys you have to watch out for with the jiu-jitsu. I think Costa has decent enough wrestling and pretty darn good jiu-jitsu. And I love the fact that Diego Lopez didn't get to use that jiu-jitsu when he was cornering Aldana in last weekend's main event. But boy, that's solid. It's going to be in the corner this weekend, and I love it for Costa.
I like Costa in the matchup, too. I think on the inside, he can do a lot of work with his boxing. Like you said, the body shots are going to be there against a guy like Flick. If Flick is able to use his movement to keep his back off the cage, he can throw a lot of kicks out there, make it a really uncomfortable fight for Costa. But I favor Costa in a lot of the exchanges on the feet. On the mat, Flick can make it interesting with just about anybody. But I think Costa can hold his own, too, in some of the grappling exchanges. So for those reasons, I have Costa in this one.
Both of us going with Brazil's no, babe. No. Don't lie. Alessandro Costa to get the win. I don't know if he's a Fergie fan, but we'll see if he can be Fergalicious this weekend. Some big time fights coming up in this card, including Vittori versus Cannoneer in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Bantamweights hang around the fringes of the deepest division in all of MMA. Battle it out at the Apex this weekend. We have the Brazilian Wonder Boy. It is Raoni Barcelos, and he's taking on the former LFA champ, Chapo Miles Johns. Marathon MMA Zone, Miles Johns. You might go, Craig, Marathon MMA, I know that name. Yes, you do. That's Trey Ogden's gym. Because for Miles Johns, his last time out, he fought Vince Morales. Go back and watch the fight. It's awful. It's terrible. They're playing touch butt in the park. They're hitting each other with single shots. They're smiling, throwing volume, not landing many shots. But the big story out of that one was Miles Johns now training out of Glory MMA and Fitness. And that week we learned that his coach couldn't make the walk. So ultimately Johns has to pick up and move, well, a few miles away and train at Marathon MMA with Trey Ogden. So Johns, another camp in Kansas City under his belt. And now he's taking on a very, very tough test in Raoni Barcelos, a guy, a five-time national wrestling champ in Brazil. He's a jiu-jitsu champion, very, very accredited in those martial arts. And if you look at it, his father set the basis. Laerte Barcelos, a guy you need to watch out for. I bet he'd be crafty from ages 30 to ages 80, Laerte Barcelos. So look out for him. He's always in the corner of his son. Barcelos doesn't necessarily look like the man that you've always seen because he's got a little bit of Benil Dariush to that salad. It has gotten a little gray. But we've said this forever. Barcellos, if he made his UFC debut at 26 and not at 31 where we did end up seeing him, maybe he wouldn't have been that underground king at 135 pounds like he was, because Barcellos beat Bobby Moffitt and Dan Moret when he was with RFA for the featherweight title. And yeah, I said featherweight title. Barcellos comes into the UFC fighting at featherweight, makes the move down to bantamweight, and I know if you look at the five on in, it is a little bit salty, like his hair at 2-3. He loses to Timur Valiev by majority decision, loses the first round, drops Valiev twice in the second round, loses the third round, and now Valiev, for some reason, is going to win the Ultimate Fighter, so it is what it is. That was weird that they let him go. He loses to Victor Henry in an all-timer of a debut for Victor Henry in that one. He then beats Trevin Jones soundly, and then Barcellos' last time out.
Gets hit by a shot he doesn't see, and that's why I have a hard time just... how much stock should I put in that fight?
So Barcellos' last time out, he fights Umar Nurmagomedov, and Nurmagomedov in the fight, a minus 850 favorite. Barcellos gets hit by a shot on the outside drop, and he gets hit by a hook that stuns him, sends him back, and then his head hits the back of the canvas. There's a follow-up hammer fist from Nurmagomedov. My big question for this fight, we saw this last weekend. Steven Erceg's great, and I think he's going to be an awesome fighter. But the flip side of that coin is, well, David Dvorak, he's gotten dropped by Manel Kopp, dropped by Mateusz Nicolau, dropped by Steven Erceg. Where are we in the grand scheme of Travis Brown chins for a guy like Hauny Barcellos late in his career at this point?
I don't think Hauny's getting knocked out to the sheer volume of a guy like Travis Brown. Like, Travis Brown was getting knocked out by everybody by the end of it. But for Barcellos, that is the big question mark, because he still has all of the skills. And if you even look at the losses that he does have by decision, he's making a good account for himself. You bring up, he has the knockdowns. He's still doing well in some of the transitions and in some scrambles. And that's the thing about Barcellos. If he's going to get beat in anything, yes, he could get hit by a big shot, get knocked out. Guess what? That can happen to anybody. He can get held down by real physically strong grapplers. He is a great grappler himself. He is really good with scrambles. But again, if you are a dominant wrestler, you will have success holding him down to some degree. But for Hauny, I'll be curious to see just how confident he feels on the outside against a guy like Miles Johns, because Miles Johns has a lot of those same questions that he has to answer in this fight. He's a big power puncher who can hold up, wait for those big shots. We've seen the uppercut before.
Against, like, Kevin Natividad. That was gross.
That shot is going to be there against Hauny. I bring up the fact that the last time out, he gets hit by a shot he doesn't see. Him in the last fight, he's looking down and gets hit by a shot kind of on the side of his head. The equilibrium gets messed up. Is he going to have that same level of confidence in the pocket? Because Hauny is at his best when he can mix his own martial arts, when he uses the volume striking and surprising pop to his shots with his own offensive wrestling. If he does that, if we just talk about the game plan of Hauny Barcellos, he can go out there and beat a guy like Miles Johns, but I think you bring up all the right questions. If Johns hits him with a big uppercut, if he hits him with a shot that can hurt the confidence of Hauny Barcellos, make him fight on the back foot and not have him that aggression that he normally fights with, I could see a world where Miles Johns kind of fights not outside of himself, but at least shows the best versions of himself in this matchup.
And Johns is one of those guys, we talked about it earlier on this card, you look at it for a guy like Jaga Zhumagulov, the record kind of precedes him being 1-5 in the UFC, but if you also consider it, I mean, UFC Vegas 75 is littered with fighters that the records don't necessarily tell the entire story, and Ronnie Lawrence is the guy who his last four wins, well, they're over decent fighters, but none of them are still in the UFC. For Miles Johns, look at the wins. Cole Smith, in a fight that Cole Smith rallied back in the third round of that one in a big way, he gets the win there. He beats Richie Santiago on Contender Series as well, does Miles Johns. Johns beats Kevin Natividad with that crazy third round uppercut. He beats Anderson Dos Santos. He beats Vince Morales. None of those guys are in the UFC anymore. Now, the losses for Miles Johns. He loses to Mario Bautista, who's going to fight Cody Garbrandt later on this summer. He's pretty darn good out of the MMA lab. And his other loss to John Castaneda, well, Castaneda just beat Muin Gafurov, so both those guys are good fighters. So Johns, it is really odd. Even his LFA fight for the title against Adrian Yanez, that one's kind of chintzy too. It was a split decision win that could have gone either way. So for Johns, what do we know? Well, like Hauny Barcellos, a really good wrestling base. High school wrestling champ. He had a wrestling scholarship in college, but injuries kind of forced him away from that, and he became a pro fighter. Johns too, kind of no sugar tonight in my coffee, no sugar tonight in my tea, no glory to stand beside me, no Kraus to corner me. That's kind of the issue for Johns in this one, but you will see a familiar face, and I'm going to talk about him later on the card too, in Trey Ogden. So for Johns, it is a lot of fire the jab out there, a good right hand from three different places. Uppercut, right hook, overhand, you're going to see it from Johns. So you can keep fighters guessing. So when it does come down to this one, Barcelos is actually heavily favored, even though he's coming off the knockout loss to the 11th-ranked Umar Nurmagomedov. For Johns, he's coming off a win over Vince Morales that was incredibly forgettable, unless you go back and watch it. When we have a look at the fan vote on this one, Matt, I don't necessarily think it's going to be all that close. And a lot of fans of the younger fighter Johns in this one, a lot of fans of the older Barcelos as well. I'm going to say over under 70% Barcelos.
Over 70%.
You think so? Under! 620 total votes, 69% Barcelos, 77% by decision. For the 31% that have Johns, 48% by decision, 45% by knockout. Matt, Miles Johns, one of those guys that the early Fight Night Picks fans really gravitated towards. Do you have him in this fight?
I don't. I think he can win by stoppage, but if I just look at the skill set of both athletes, I gotta go with Barcelos on it. I like his volume, I like his activity, I like his ability to scramble out of bad situations. Again, if he gets stopped and flatlined, that's one thing, right? You can't keep on fighting if the fight's over, but as long as Howney's in the matchup, I do like his overall work rate.
And it was tough to see. Left hook drops him, head bounces off the canvas, follow-up hammer fist, and then Nurmagomedov backed right off because he realized how bad the knockout loss was. Eager to see Barcelos in this one, because at one point in his career, again, Laerte trained, then he went to refit pro fighters with Pedro Hizo, but also cross-training at all times at Atos BJJ. And there's one Atos BJJ in California. We've seen a lot of fighters out of that gym in the past. A lot of Alliance fighters training out of there. But you know some big-time names like Davi Hamosh out of that camp. So Davi, gonna be there and giving the old Spider-Man in the back to Armin Zarukian, a former common opponent. Matt, I also have Haony Barcelos in the fight. I think he can win out in the wrestling, went out in the jiu-jitsu, and if he can stay away from a big power shot, I think he can get it done on the outside. His leg kicks are very good as well, so look out for those in the fight. Matt, both of us going with Brazil's Haony Barcelos to move the clock forward just a little bit, even though that hourglass is starting to run out at 36. A big-time matchup again in this bantamweight division. Okay. You have some big-time fights in this card, including Marvin Vettori taking on Jared Cannonier, so you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Crafty welterweight veterans battle it out in the small cage. We have the 2008 near Olympian, the king of kung fu, but really Wushu Saad the champ. It is Muslim Salikov taking on Danish dynamite Nicholas Dalby. And if there's two great nicknames in the welterweight division, it's the Argentine Dagger and Danish Dynamite. And both of those guys found the nicknames later on in life. And what I saw to Nicholas Dalby later on in life, his last time out against Warley Alves, who at times fights like Muslim Salikov, man, did Dalby ever look good in that fight? I was so impressed on the rewatch at how good Dalby looked, pressuring forward, looking like Mac from Always Sunny, because for Dalby, you always know he's going to be always just breathing so damn loud into the mics, and they pick it all up. But for Dalby, it's not necessarily the takedown defense that gets some wins. It's a lot of volume on the outside and a lot of on his way in all the time, and he crashes forward into his opponents. You saw that to maximum full effect where a fight had to be stopped due to blood loss against Ross Houston, and that is one of two no contests on the record of Nicholas Dalby. But the crazy part of it for Dalby, since he's come back into the UFC, it's a nice little record. He's got a no contest against Jesse Ronson, which originally was a loss, but Ronson, it's overturned due to some USADA complications. He had beaten Alex Oliveira on the Copenhagen card, which had a main event of Jared Cannonier in that one. Dalby looked great in that fight against Oliveira. He gets a win over Daniel Rodriguez, which is a really, really chintzy one. He loses to Tim Means, and then his last two times out, he outlasts old Claudio Silva, and he looked really good against Warley Alves in a very, very hard-fought fight by both of those guys. It was a split decision win for Dalby.
I think it is fair to say, though, Dalby's two last wins are over guys whose best days are behind them. So for Dalby,
I don't know about that for Alves.
Warley Alves is not getting better, though. Warley Alves is in his mid-30s. Like, Warley Alves, I don't think the grass is greener.
You're thinking about, he looked really good against Munir Lazez recently.
But we're talking about his level of competition being reduced to such to where he's not really the fighter that he once was. Like, Warley Alves was fighting Randy Brown. Randy Brown is a ranked fighter. Like, he is a very good one at that. I don't think Warley Alves, and I think a lot of people would back me up on this, is not in his prime.
Randy Brown wasn't ranked then. Colby Covington wasn't ranked then. Warley Alves Aldo's never fought very big rank
fighters. But he was fighting guys who all had high expectations, who all had high ceilings. At the time, all those fighters were thought of as very good fighters, and Wirly Alves himself was. Wirly Alves is not in the prime of his career by any means, and neither is Claudio. So for Nicholas Dalby and for Muslim Salikov, this is an oddly important fight, I think, for both guys, even though Dalby has had two wins, and Salikov's coming off a win himself, because for Salikov, the last time he did fight sort of one of those fringe guys on the rankings was that Li Xingliang loss. And I know he had some areas of success in the matchup.
Won the first round handily.
But when Li Xingliang was able to get on the inside, use his jab to the body and answer with the overhand, Muslim did not do a great job striking on the back foot once Li Xingliang was able to establish that inside distance. So for Salikov, it really is going to come into, can he keep his back off the cage? Because I think Nicholas Dalby can do some real damage, not only with his striking, but with the threat of his grappling too, if Salikov is the much more stationary target. But if Salikov can, I'm not saying completely stay away from the two black lines, like he's going to have to back up at some point, but maintain his distance in the center of the cage and use his movement to where he's not letting Dalby completely cut him off, I could see Salikov, and this is the weird thing, I don't think he's going to run away with striking numbers by any means. I don't think it's going to be like a Max Holloway type performance, but the threat of the big power shot and him landing enough shots of his own on the outside, I think it'd be enough for him to go out there and win rounds consistently.
And people are going to discount Muslim Salikov's last win against Andrea Fialho because of what's happened to Fialho's career in the short UFC time that it has been. And if you look at Salikov, what does he do so well in that fight? He lands the kicks to back off the boxer, and then from there establishes distance. He ends up getting the spin kick to the body that ends up getting the finish. But if you look at it for Salikov, he did punch his ticket to the UFC the same way that Israel Adesanya did, by a spinning poor knockout Melvin win over Melvin Gallard. Salikov then loses to Canadian-Cuban wrestler Alex Garcia, but then he goes on a wild win streak. Beats Ricky Rainey, beats Nurdin Taleb, beats Laureano Staropoli, beats Eliseo Zaleski de Santos in a terrible fight, awful. Beats Francisco Trinaldo in a bad fight, and then against Li Xingliang, beats him by striking and wrestling in the first round. In the second round, Salikov's walking down Li, goes to land a jab that gets slipped and then countered with a right hand by Li that rocks Salikov, and then you ultimately have Li getting the finish. Now, in that fight, Li Xingliang ranked 14th in the division, and Salikov was favored to beat him as the older fighter, so a little bit crazier to see, but Salikov's last time out, he is a favorite against Andrea Fialho and gets a big finish win. And if you look at it, technique for technique's sake, Muslim Salikov being an honored master of sport, Mushu Sanda, it's not enough to say that. The guy has the technique videos out there. You see it in his fights. But the sneakiest part of his game is that threat of the takedown from Salikov. And he is very powerful when he goes for them. I mean, he picked up and threw Li Xingliang in their fight when he was going for it.
Li Xingliang still did a really good job at striking in the mat.
And like, Nicholas Dalby,
you can have the backup
struggles
that you have, but still, it's not like Salikov's just the greatest striker we've ever seen at welterweight. Like, he does have struggles, especially on the inside. If you can just force him to be a boxer, his hands are a little bit looping. He is going to throw wider shots. So I do think there are some susceptibilities to his style of striking.
What fight did you see that in other than the Li Xingliang fight where he struggled with it?
Well, in a lot of them, that's the thing. That's why I bring up, he's not going to wow you with the volume numbers. The threat of a lot of his strikes is going to be enough to where his opponents are just going to be willing to throw a lot of wild volume in there. But again, when Li got on the inside, there wasn't a lot of threat with the big power shots of Salikov. He did a great job with his boxing.
It'll be interesting to see, again, for both of these guys. Muslim Salikov, he has cross-trained at a lot of big gyms throughout the world. American Top Team for this one. For Nicholas Dalby, Rumble Sports in his native Copenhagen. If you do look at it, Salikov favored in the matchup. Both guys looking to string together some wins all of a sudden. If we do consider the fan vote on Tapology to try and get a little bit of a finger on the pulse of what the fans are thinking, I set the over-under. I say over-under 75% Salikov.
I think it'll be over.
It's going to be over. It is over. 643 total votes, 84% Salikov, 65% by decision for the 16% that have Dalby, 79% by decision. And the reason I bring up Dalby's last fight as a little bit of a litmus test, yes, I know Dalby, he's had bonuses in the UFC, had a fight of the night draw against Darren Till years ago in that first UFC tenure. Dalby's one of those guys that if he's doing that striking forward, if he pressures his opponent up against the fence, he can do a lot of damage with the guy backed up against the fence. If Dalby's backed up against the fence, nothing happens. And he's held up a lot and he struggles in that position. So we'll see how that plays out for both these guys, because there are times where Salikov is behind the black line and he waits and he waits and he waits and then he can't get off his own shot. So for me, I do have Muslim Salikov in the fight. I think he can make Dalby pay with some of his power shots. We had never seen Dalby really get like finished, dropped, submitted until that Jesse Ronson fight. So we will see how that plays out for him in this matchup, but I will go with Salikov in the fight here.
This is how I look at this fight. It's going to be a close fight when it goes to decision. I don't think it's going to end inside the distance, and I think the significant strike numbers are going to be really close on both sides. But the difference is, not every significant strike is created equally. That's why MMA judging is weird, because you can't just look at numbers on a page and tell you the whole story. I think the strikes that Salikov's going to land are going to be a little bit bigger and a little bit more effective, so I agree with you. I do have Salikov in the matchup, but this should be a really fun fight, because again, both guys have had kind of taste at those top 15 opponents, and for Salikov, 39 years old, and Dalby too, no spring chicken either, 38, so you wonder how many more chances they are going to get at that top level of opposition, so big fight for both guys.
And a happy birthday to Muslim Salikov, who just turned 39, 6-2 in the UFC versus the 5-3-1 with a no contest, Nicholas Dalby. Matt, both of us going with King of Kung Fu in the fight. But you let us know who you have in this matchup, because I was so amped up when Dalby came back to fight Alex Oliveira. Awesome to see him back on the big stage and in a matchup at the UFC's Apex. That's a little bit of a duh-duh-duh. But Matt, some big time fights left on this card, including one Nicholas Mata taking on Manuel Torres. You're not going to want to miss that one. Keep locked in with Fight in Apex, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Lightweight banger coming up this weekend. Boxing supremacy on the line. We have Mexico's El Loco Manuel Torres taking on Iron Nicholas Mata out of Extreme Couture. And if you're not excited about this fight, you should be, because both these guys come to bang. And when you consider for Nicholas Mata, the much more well-known commodity to MMA fans for a longer period of time, he debuted on The Ultimate Fighter Brazil Season 4, a season that was supposed to be headlined by Anderson Silva taking on Shogun Hua. Season didn't end that way, but that's what it was supposed to be. And for Nicholas Mata, he was actually picked higher up on the season by Anderson Silva than Joaquim Silva, who's in the co-main event of this weekend's card. And the craziest part about it is, for Nicholas Mata, he had Joaquim Silva in his corner on Dana White's Contender Series when he fought a few years ago. So wild parallels out of Brazil, and I'm sure they're going to be chumming it up coming up ahead of this weekend's card. But if we do look at it for Nicholas Mata, he takes on Glycao França on that opening round of the show. He lands a head kick, he drops França, and then he ends up getting finished by submission. And that's a scary thing when you want to pick a fight for either one of these guys. Mata, for what it's worth, 13 wins. He's got plenty of finish wins on that record. He gets it done with his hands and his boxing. He will go to the well with his two attacks, overhand right head kick. But for Mata, he's been finished in all of his losses. And we saw that against Jim Miller. We saw that on The Ultimate Fighter. We saw that with, 864 promotions. It's a struggle that Mata's going to have when he tries to pick that one right shot, where sometimes he can get caught in the mirror and hit. Mata's one of those guys from a young age training at big gyms. Novo Inhao, before he came to the States to train at Extreme Couture, he's always been there with a lot of good guys in the gym. But the same thing can be said for Manuel Torres, who fights like somebody's got a lighter under his ass.
Like a banshee.
He goes so hard. And when you consider the gyms and getting ready for these fights, Mata out of Extreme Couture, he was supposed to take on a really tough fighter in Ignacio Bahamondes back a few months ago. Manuel Torres was supposed to take on Trey Ogden a few months ago. Neither guy could make the walk, so let's have Bahamondes fight Trey Ogden. And Bahamondes got the win there. But if you do look at it in this one, Torres getting ready for this fight. He is trained at, and I will quote, some of the biggest gyms. We're talking about Entram Gym, MMA Masters, in Vegas with some really good fighters. Also, Centro Deportivo Tibet out of Spain with one Joel Alvarez, who's got a big-time fight coming up in the not-so-distant future against Mark Chakasi in July in the UK card. So, Matt, for Manuel Torres, I know he got that submission win over the Canada, El Cañeda, where he pulls on the guillotine as tight as I've ever seen one popped. Like he was Josh Fremd against Trayshawn Gore.
Wow, shout out.
But, Matt, when I'm watching Manuel Torres fights, like, I get a phoner.
And it's going to be really interesting to see how Mata deals with the flurry that is Manuel Torres. Because the thing about Mata is, he is a great power striker when he's able to land that power shot. But he leads with his chin and not his hand. He'll go like this. You can get a better look this way. I have a big nose, I know. Ready? And then boom. And that's what I do really worry about, because if Nicolas Motta is trying to land that big power shot, really overcommitting to a lot of these, Manuel Torres is like death by a thousand cuts. Even though he is a powerful striker, he's going to throw a lot at you. And by sheer volume, it's going to give him a great chance to hurt a guy like Motta. And the thing about Manuel Torres is if he hurts him, he's going to throw that extra flurry.
Where's Nicolas Motta on the Andre Arlovsky chin rate? That's what it is.
It is because, now, here's the honest thing. Jim Miller could be the greatest knockout artist we've ever seen at this division, and hey, you could be right if you say that, but for Motta, it's not a great sign that he was knocked out by a guy who is so advanced in his career, when that is the thing that gives Motta so much success. I know the nickname's Iron, but we've seen him get cracked a lot, and when you are, I don't want to call him a 50-50 striker, he's like a 65-35 striker, you know, he's going to win a lot of the exchanges, but he is susceptible to the big strike. If he can disrupt Manuel Torres's rhythm, though, I do think Motta can have a lot of success, because Torres is a guy who, once he gets going, he really likes to keep that rhythm and maintain his distance, maintain his output. And if Motta can disrupt it, land the big power shot, hurt the confidence to where he's not able to just stand in the pocket, land his own shots, and really get his volume numbers up to win the rounds, I could see Motta being able to land some of those big counter strikes. But if my prediction is, oh, I think Torres is going to win a lot of the moments unless Motta lands that big shot, it is difficult for me, not to see a world where Motta wins. I'm not saying that at all. But it's difficult for me to see how Motta wins by decision, I guess is what I'm saying, because I do think he is going to be waiting a lot for the big shot.
Torres burns so friggin' hot. If he makes it to the second round, it would surprise me, because Torres is one of those guys. I think he has decent jiu-jitsu. I think he has okay wrestling. He trains with some really good fighters. Like that, Maciel Fullen trains at that gym, and he's fallen on hard times in terms of MMA and winning. So you're not necessarily your training partners, but Manuel Torres, for its credit, performance of the night bonus against, at that time, 7-fight UFC vet Frank Camacho. They had a firefight. Torres took Camacho's best shots, so you could see the chin of Torres, but he ends up pulling out the knockout win, drops Camacho, follows it up with some ground and pound. When you look at it for Motta, again, the similarities with fighters on this card, if you watch the preamble into Contender Series, well, I mean, Motta, he's a CFFC champ, just like Pat Sabatini was in the next fight. He also has trained with some big fighters out of Brazil. And in one of those pictures, I saw the big time smiley smile out of Jaime Barcelos is also on this fight card. So some parallels there. But for Motta, it's a lot of, again, the boxing combinations, the leg kick, the overhead. He will throw that head kick with his right foot. But when you consider for both these guys, obviously the right hook in close for Jim Miller, it dropped Motta, and that was a finishing sequence. But against Cameron Van Camp, it was Motta able to go out there against a bigger, taller fighter, which is similar to the parallel of a Manuel Torres fight. And Motta was able to land at will, eat some of the power shots of Van Camp, and keep on ticking. So when I do consider this matchup, Matt, I see this a lot like an AHL hockey fight between Fredericton, New Brunswick's own Eric Nielsen and the biggest hockey fighter of all time, Steve McIntyre, where, and I'll link it in the comments section, the guy who was calling that one had some things to say, like, those are man-sized punches, as well as his nose looks like a stick of butter in July, and wow, that was a five-knuckle tango exhibition.
That guy was so excited for that fight.
It's one of the best hockey fights. If you've never seen it, which you probably haven't, you should. So I will link that below. But Matt, this will be a big time fight. This is one of my favorite fights on the card. Torres, a slight favorite in this one. I think the fans will side with him. I'm going to say over under 65% Torres.
I think it'll be over.
It's going to be over. It's way over. 602 total votes, 85% Torres, 82% by knockout. For the 15% that have Motta, 47% by decision, 42% by decision. Count me in as a 15%. I've got Nicolas Motta in this one to outlast Manuel Torres. I think Motta can keep a high shell like we've seen him in a lot of his fights and withstand some of the pressure, because Torres burns so gosh darn hot. And we haven't seen him in over a year since he had that fight against Frank Camacho. So for me, I like Nicolas Motta in this fight, but going back and watching the tape on Torres, boy, oh boy, see, fun to watch.
And I do have Torres in the matchup. Again, it's a close fight. Both guys could get stopped really at any moment, but I think he's going to be able to win a lot of the in-betweens. And you're right, he does burn hot, but I'm hoping he takes the foot off the gas a little bit, because he does have good volume, and if he can just extend that into that second and third round, I do think we could be dealing with an exciting top-level prospect is too high a praise, but just a decent fighter moving forward, because he does have great skills to build on. So I do have Torres in the matchup, but this is a great fight.
I mean, I wrote down for the former beatdown champ, Manuel Torres, elbows, knees, looping shots, straight shots. Craig, write down everything he
and
does.
Shoulders, knees, and toes.
Six wins by knockout, six wins by submission for Torres. And if you consider it, not necessarily a giant submission threat, even though there's 6 submission wins. The level of competition, not the greatest on the regional scene for Torres. Matt, split on the pick in this one. I'm going Iron Nicholas Mota. You're going with El Loco Manuel Torres. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big-time matchups on this card, including Vittori and Cannoneer in the main event. And up next, Pat Sabatini taking on Lucas Almeida. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Featherweights mixing it up in the UFC's Apex coming up this weekend. Former Contender Series fight loser, yet a guy who's looking to string together 2 wins in a row in the UFC. We have the former Jungle Fights lightweight champ Lucas Almeida taking on the former 2-time CFFC champ, a guy who's looking to get back on a win streak. It is Pat Sabatini out of that big time gym in the Philly area. He's a Daniel Gracie guy, is Pat Sabatini, and both of these guys, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts, but you wouldn't guess it if you watched Lucas Almeida fight, because this guy throws everything into his
does
hooks
he ever.
And he lays it all out on the line in his matchups. And for Sabatini, he was on a giant roll. He got to the fringes of the elite in the featherweight division, and he took on Action Jackson, Damon Jackson. At that time, in that matchup, Sabatini favored to get the win. In it, he got cracked.
He did.
And just like he did when he fought Jamal Emmers, he couldn't grapple his way out of it.
And that's the thing about Pat Sabatini. Some fighters get hurt. Some fighters get dropped. Sabatini, at least early on, could recover, right? He'd get dropped by a big shot, recover, panic, takedown. And then once he initiated the grappling, well, we all know how talented of a fighter he is on the mat. He's a very heavy fighter on top, has good ground and pound. We know how good the submissions are as well. So he would be able to work out of a lot of those bad positions. But as his career has progressed, and he is 32, it's not like he's an old fighter, but again, the miles is starting to add up. He hasn't been able to recover all that well after getting hit by the big shot, and that is a little bit concerning when you're fighting a guy like Almeida.
You gotta back it up, because people are gonna say, Matt, like, we haven't seen him get knocked out in a lot of these fights, and that's true. Like, the
he get dropped enough times, though.
Okay, show us the fights, because the CFFC fight that's considered a TKO loss, he dislocates his elbow.
Well, no, the Emmers fight, though, is a concerning fight.
The fight against Emmers, he gets dropped. The fight against Damon Jackson, he gets dropped. Those are some examples, but he has shown resolve, albeit, again, 1 due to injury and 1 a terrible knockout loss his last time out. Now, for Sabatini, I sat here and I wondered, why haven't we seen him since the Damon Jackson fight? So I went out and I sought out some interviews. And I found a new interviewer. So he did one on June 7th with Dan. So in that one, for the first time, I thought that just every morning Pat Sabatini wakes up, somebody pisses in his Cheerios, and that's why he looks mad all the time. But I actually saw Dan. He made Pat smile. So Pat Sabatini, he has a real smile. And in it, he actually said something that I didn't know. That sounds pretentious, but if you look at Sabatini's Tapology page, SureDog, Records, wherever it is, it doesn't show him in any matchups after the Damon Jackson fight. Pat said he was matched up June 10th at UFC 289 to fight Atlanta Canadian Gavin Tucker again. And Tucker pulled out of that fight. So it was announced by Marcel Dorf on May 19th that Sabatini would be stepping up in place of Hakeem Dawodu to take on Lucas Almeida. Flip of the coin, Lucas Almeida, after that fight that he had against Mike Trezano, where he just absolutely floors and rallies back against the former Ultimate Fighter winner Trezano, he was booked to take on Takugov. Takugov couldn't make the weight. Andre Feely, that fight fell out, and then Hakeem Dawodu. It's awesome to see Almeida back in a matchup. And when you look at this fight, where Almeida does have the grappling pedigree, and he trains out of a good gym, one that you don't hear about, in Equipe Rivera Black Team down in Brazil, teammate of recent LFA champ Adolfo Bellotto, who you saw in Contender Series get floored. If you do look at it for Almeida, all of those successes on the regional scene at lightweight, drops down to featherweight, looks really good against Trezano, even though the chin got checked in the first round. He drops Trezano round 2, drops him round 3. Almeida's one of those guys that, going back and watching his fights on the regional scene, he struggled with the takedown defense. His fight against Nico Cocuchillo, in that one, he floors Cocuchillo to the point where Cocuchillo's got to, like, butt scoot and get his way back up to the feet after he gets dropped multiple times in the first round. But he rallies back, does his opponent, takes down Almeida, wears on him, and then by the end of it, Almeida gets the finish. I love the resolve that I seen out of Almeida, even in the fight that he had against Zell Huber, which is a fight in the night on Contender Series. It's just, it's tricky. for both of these guys to see a win. I have a hard time. The tape study didn't make it any easier.
This is what I like in it, too. Think about the NBA Finals right now, right? Nikola Jokic, a big conversation point right now. If you're the Nuggets, this is what you have to do, right? He's the best player in the world. That's what a lot of people believe. You win every minute he's on the court, right? So he has to rest. What do you do in the minutes he's off the court, right? Can you just not bleed a lot of points? I look at both these guys' game plans as being very similar. Can you just not lose all the moments in your opponent's wheelhouse? Because Almeida can have this fight and understand, okay, I can get taken down as long as I don't get finished. Because he is coming off a fight, and I don't think Trezano is a perfect game plan to just recycle and recreate for Sabatini, but it's a decent one to go with, right? For the bare bones, what does Mike Trezano do? He's got good boxing on the outside. I would say he's more of a boxer than Sabatini. Sabatini much more of a grappler, but he's going to box, he's going to wrestle, he's going to be that well-rounded fighter.
He's going to leave the UFC on a knockout win over Sungmu Choi.
Exactly. So maybe Sabatini fights Choi next, but you know what I mean. Almeida can have those similar areas of success in this matchup. I just worry that, is Sabatini's chin too far gone? If he gets hit by that one big shot by Almeida and tries to panic for the takedown, is he going to get it? Because if he does fight like he did against Jamal Emmers, then okay, he can get hit by that big shot, get the top position, and still have success. But if he gets hit by the shot, and that's just kind of it for him, I could see Almeida coming in and just getting the biggest win of his career.
And if you do consider it, I mean, Sabatini, the grappling lineage, the BJJ black belt, Marquez MMA, Daniel Gracie, that gym was on fire, and now all of a sudden some of the guys have been losing, Sean Brady, Pat Sabatini as well. But if you look at it for Sabatini, D1 wrestling chops at one Rider University, a much younger Patrick Sabatini in the wrestling days, putting on the shoes, getting it done. You have a look at it. Sabatini had aspirations of the top 15, a little bit stifled his last time out. Favored to get the win over to Almeida, but Matt, you can never count out Almeida. Yeah. I think the fans, listen, Fight Night Picks fans are Sabatini fans, so I'm going to say over under 80% Sabatini.
I think it'll be under.
I don't want to get pulled into the trap. It is under. 541 total votes, 68% Sabatini, 82% have him to win by decision for the 32% that have Almeida, 71% by knockout. And that's a sexy pick, Almeida by knockout, because Trezano's got an all right chin, and Almeida dropped him twice exactly in that matchup. Sabatini's been tested in his last number of fights. Now, for Sabatini in these matchups, like, you consider it, 85% of almost 4,000 votes had Sabatini to beat Jackson. And if you look at the matchups that Sabatini's had so far in the UFC, we're talking about takedown after takedown after takedown. He was able to get it done against Canadian TJ Laramie and put up 6 on the board in that one. He had 5 against Tucker Lutz, and in his matchup against Jamal Emmers, the heel hook win. And in his fight against Tristan Connolly, in tight, lands that shot, drops Connolly in the first round, and he's able to ground him out as that one went on. I think there's more of a story about dropping from 170 to 145 and neck injuries for Tristan Connolly, but it is what it is. Matt, I picked Pat Sabatini to win this fight, but people bitch every week about this. Oh, I see it being a close fight. I have a hard time being really confident with it because of what I've seen out of Sabatini. And Lucas Almeida is not going to go down without trying to land those big hooks. And they come from odd angles. He could very well finish Sabatini.
He very well could, but I do agree with you on the pick. I think Sabatini's going to make use of the takedown when he is able to accomplish it. Could Almeida hurt him on the feet? Yes, of course he could. At any moment throughout this fight, he has shown the ability to carry his power very late in fights. But he has been taken down multiple times in a lot of his fights. And that's the problem. I brought this up a lot when Amir Albazi fought Kai Kara France. I know I got the pick right, even though the decision was a little chintzy, but the reason I gave that prediction was Amir Albazi is really good at controlling his opponents, right? And Kai Kara France, for as good as he is at getting back up to his feet, he does give up that initial takedown, and I do look at this fight as being slightly similar to that. Almeida can make use of the time on the feet. I just think he's going to get held down once he is taken down.
Almeida's had 3 different fights fall out. He's kind of in his Nick the Tooth phase, looking for a fight. Just wants to get it back. Matt, Lucas Almeida is not the guy we have. Both of us going with Pat Sabatini to get the win. Some big time matchups on this fight card, including Armin Petrosian taking on Christian Leroy Duncan next. Little CLD, you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time middleweight fight on this UFC Vegas 75 card. We have the real debut of England's CLD, Christian Leroy Duncan, the former Cage Warriors champ, and he's taking on Superman Armin Petrosian, a guy who's co-main evented a UFC fight, a guy who appeared on Dana White's Contender Series, a guy who can really get it done, the former world champ in Muay Thai, Armin Petrosian. Not that Armin Petrosian. However, he is pretty damn good. Former AMC Fight Nights Global light heavyweight champ is Petrosian. And when you go back and you watch some of his fights, he is a meat and potatoes Muay Thai striker. And what do I mean by that? He keeps his hands dangerously low between his waist and his chest. They really do hang low. But he will throw those big looping hooks, some really good kicks, a nice reset on it. And you saw it out of Petrosian his last time out. Prelims of a pay-per-view card against Mark Coleman protege. Mark Coleman going to be boxing in October, and that's scary. But through Mark Coleman's yells were Petrosian's lands on the outside against Dobson, who was plotting forward. And you can see a lot of good things out of that. And when you look at a guy like Christian Leroy Duncan, we love his striking. He's like a bigger Raymond Daniels. He can really get it done. 720 spins, exactly. The spinning back elbow that he was able to land in an actual title fight a few fights ago against Marion Dimitrov that ended up punching his ticket into the UFC. It wasn't supposed to be, because Christian Leroy Duncan on New Year's Eve was supposed to fight Jesse Taylor. But Taylor got in a car accident before the fight, so they scrapped it, and Duncan gets a shot in the UFC. And then Duncan's fighting Dusko Todorovic in a fun one where they're grappling up against the fence. Dusko reverses position, torques on his knee, lands on it, and then that's the end of the fight. So it's unfortunate that the fight against Taylor didn't happen, that the fight against Dusko didn't really even get to start. Now, ultimately, we get it. And I say meat and potatoes. Armin Petrosian, he's like my guy. I'm going to see him in August, Matt. It's like listening to a Chris Stapleton record. It's meat and potatoes, and you're going to enjoy it. But CLD, it's like Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf. If you've never heard it, you don't know what's going on, but it is a lot of damn fun when it's going down.
It's an interesting fight because for Petrosian, he does a great job at closing the distance, even though his hands are down. He does mix his footwork in with his boxing, even though he does like the kicking range the most. He's a fighter who's going to fight on the very outside, but he does do a really good job at blitzing in and catching his opponents off guard when he does decide to throw his hands too. And that's nothing surprised to see. It's odd because his hands down style will get him caught when he does blitz in, but it also does disguise some of those bigger looping shots as he is able to land them. So for Petrosian, it's going to matter. Can he do enough at the kicking range to get the respect of Leroy Duncan? Because if Duncan's able to just box his way in, be that a whirling dervish is kind of the proper term, I guess, because he does get ugly on the inside. The kid's a bear cat. And if he is able to use his elbows, use some of the more, it's odd. You know, when you think Muay Thai, you think knees and elbows, right? Petrosian, I would say, is more likely to throw kicks from the outside and then kind of lean in with his boxing, whereas Duncan is going to throw more elbow and knee techniques. So I do think the inside is where Duncan can have a lot of success.
It's like if you took Rod Tang and took his skills down the middle and gave one to one guy and one to the
other. You know what I mean? Well, for Petrosian, you would assume, oh, Muay Thai, you're going to think about a lot of the elbows. But I think on the inside, if Duncan's able to get it into the clinch, not only does that A, limit the movement of Petrosian, but it's going to help him land some of those more in-tight power shots that he is well known for.
Now, if you look at it for Petrosian, under the Endeavor banner, Contender Series, and in the UFC, the takedown to defense, it's bad. 4 of 16 takedowns has Petrosian defended successfully. That means that 12 of them he's given up.
That's
and
not
if
good.
You look at it for Petrosian, everybody's going to try and take you down. It's the Holly Holm hallmark. He fights Kolev over on Contender Series. He gets that win over there. He then beats Gregory Rodriguez by split decision. He loses to Caio Bahalio, where he does get taken down and held down.
That's a good fighter, though.
And then he beats AJ Dobson. If you look at it for Christian Leroy Duncan, the Jody Milan fight is one where he gets taken down early in the first round, held down for the majority of the first round. Milan starts to tire. Duncan takes over with the striking. Duncan does have a submission win over Moore, but in that one, you go back and you watch it. Poor Moore was in over his head in that fight. But when you consider for Armin Petrosian and you look at the fact that 7 of these 8 wins are by finish, I went back and I tried to figure out, okay, where is he really starting to struggle meeting some resistance? Gregory Rodriguez did a good job with the judo and the striking, and some people thought that Gregory won, but it's neither here nor there.
Close fight.
The fight that Petrosian had against Artur Alaskarov over at MMA Festival, in that one, going back and watching it, Alaskarov ends up tiring and losing in the second round. He gets dropped. He's walking away from the fight at the end of it. It's tough, but he's walking down Petrosian, who's on the back foot with those low stances, and Alaskarov's landing because Petrosian, again, walking back with his hands down, getting hit. Then Petrosian becomes the wrestler and has success with his takedowns, and it was really a mind fump if you've ever heard of one. For Christian Leroy Duncan, going back and watching the tape, he's going to have to worry about the same things as Petrosian. Guys are going to try and take him down. His takedown defense is okay. Before his last fight, he was training with Phil Haas down at Tiger Muay Thai to get ready for Dusko. In this one, he's training at home. That's Range Martial Arts Academy. With Mark Weir, UFC veteran Mark Weir, the 10-second knockout over Eugene Jackson, that guy. But if you look at it for Duncan, he comes in with his hands at about head height, but he enters and inserts himself into the fight with his head on the center line. He will move on the outside, but when he's making his entries, the head's up and he stands really tall. So both these guys kind of suffer from some of those flaws. But guys, I mean, one guy's undefeated as a pro, and one guy's 8-2. So I don't have any negative things to say about them. They're both very, very good fighters. This fight's really going to come down to the range. Can Petrosian utilize those kicks and the big hooks to keep Duncan away from him? Because if so, Duncan on the outside doesn't really do much. He's got to get his work done in tight with those. He throws wild combinations. He throws things from odd angles. He keeps his opponents guessing from round one to round three and beyond. I love the matchup, Matt. Duncan favored in this one. I have no idea where the fan vote's going to be, so I'm going to let you set it on Tapology.
I'm going to set it at 60% Duncan.
I'm going to say over on that one. I think the fans like Duncan. 655 total votes, 77% Duncan, 39% by decision, 54% by knockout for the 23% that have Petrosian, 73% by decision. I think Petrosian can cause Duncan a lot of issues that a guy like Dushko wouldn't have in the last matchup. Getting ready for that one.
I have the underdog in this fight. I didn't think I was going to heading into this, but upon further film study, I just think Petrosian's not going to get hit a lot on the outside, but I'm going to say this too. I don't know if he's going to land a bunch of crippling shots either. Like, I think this could be a bit of a chess match from the outside because both guys are such talented strikers, and I think Duncan realizes, hey, if I do just blitz my way in without being cognizant of the dangers in front of me, Petrosian can land a big bomb and end the fight quite rapidly, so I'm going to have the slight underdog Petrosian.
Give me Paradise by the Dashboard Light. I like CLD in the matchup because I've seen Petrosian, he's done a really good job at mixing in his strikes and mixing in his combinations. He will rip one to the body to then follow it up with a kick. You saw that against AJ Dobson his last time out, won all three rounds in spectacular fashion without getting the finish, but he did get bloodied up on some of those entries. And Duncan's a guy that, again, like I said, he mixes things in really well, and I think if he's able to pressure Petrosian to turn Petrosian maybe even into a grappler, that's where Petrosian could struggle against a guy like Duncan. So we're split on the pick. I do have CLD in this matchup. Matt going with Superman Armin Petrosian. If Armin Petrosian wins, I mean, Fazeev's had wild callouts in his career. Do you think Armin goes, I could be your Superman, your Superman, your Superman? He calls out Eminem.
For some reason, I was thinking Enrique Iglesias. I can be your hero, baby. But no, I don't think he's going to. I don't think he's a big Eminem guy. Do you think?
Nah, but I do know that Petrosian getting ready for this one, training at ATT with Armin Zarukian, who's in the next fight. He's also training back home with Roman Kopylov, a pretty darn good guy if you want to mimic a little bit of the boxing and some of the wrestling that you could see in a matchup like this at middleweight. Again, split on the pick in the matchup. Let us know who you have. That next fight, Matt, the co-main event, Armin Zarukian taking on Joaquim Silva. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
One of the strangest co-main events you're ever going to witness. Coming up this weekend, American Top Team Zone, Joaquim Silva takes on American Top Team Zone, Armin Zarukian, in a battle of will. And Matt, when we do consider this matchup for Joaquim Silva's last time out, he's taking on the Canadian, Jesse Ronson. And in that one, he sent Jesse Ronson packing to become the super lightweight champ with Samurai MMA in Quebec, Canada.
Listen, when one door closes, another sometimes
Silva opens. Gets the win in that fight, and now he finds himself in a matchup with Armin Zarukian. And if you look at it for Zarukian and you consider his overall MMA run, he gave the toughest test other than Adriano Martins to the now lightweight champ, Islam Makhachev. That was Zarukian's foray into the UFC, a fight of the night against Islam Makhachev. But if you look at the wins that a guy like Zarukian has so far, beats Joel Alvarez, beats Mateusz Gamrot, beats Demiris Magulov, and then Zarukian back in April loses to Gamrot in a fight that people didn't think that he won. The weirdest part for me is Armin Zarukian must hate his training partners at ATT because Gamrot trains at ATT, that's a loss. Then you also look at it, Ismagulov trains at ATT, he beats him. Armin Zarukian's supposed to fight Hanato Moicano, who trains at ATT in a main event. And now he gets ATT Joaquim Silva. It's got to be awkward in the training room when you're looking at a guy like Armin Zarukian.
It probably is, but let's just get down to brass tacks. Like, when I first watched Armin Zarukian fight Islam Makhachev and make a great account of himself on short notice, I thought, oh, well, that's weird. You know, like, you can have an outlier performance. Remember when Mike Miller lost one of his basketball shoes, still hit all those threes? Like, you can have an outlier performance, but You don't show up on short notice and have competitive fights with guys who are ranked. What's my Jim Miller rule, Craig? You can't beat Jim Miller on short notice unless you're a ranked fighter. It just can't happen. Like, unless you're in the top 15 and you have 50 fights under your belt, it's pretty hard to beat a guy with that level of experience and those skills still in his repertoire and have a competitive fight. I don't think Armin beat Islam. That's not what I'm saying. But the fact that he was able to continue some of those grappling exchanges and not just get held down by the vastly superior and bigger fighter, too, because that's the thing about Armin that's always kind of stood out to me. He is not a big lightweight fighter at all. If he fought a Dustin Poirier type, if he fought a Charles Oliveira, when he fought Islam, we saw it. And even when he fought Gamrot, who was floated between divisions, but still, when he fights all these guys, he's the smaller fighter most of the time. So for Sarukian, I am curious to see if that ever does play up or if that is a big factor. Because let's say he does beat Silva. He is a massive favorite too. He is one of the more well-known commodities in this division and one of the more pushed fighters too, because that's been the thing for Armin Sarukian. And it is nice to see. He's not a guy who's going to get on the mic and say outlandish things, right? But the UFC has put him in good matchups and at the forefront of a lot of these cards, which is nice because he has a pretty good fighting style. Like, look at the Joel Alvarez fight. People want to watch more fights like that. He does have a good skill set.
And if you look at it on the overall, you know, kind of level of this card, you have a guy in Manuel Torres that's taking on Nicolas Mota. Torres trained for his fight with Joel Alvarez, so I bet you backstage he's going to be all pissed. And you also have Armin Sarukian, who's taking on Joaquim Silva, who's on The Ultimate Fighter Season 4 Brazil, where Glyco França beats Nicolas Mota, who's on this card, then beats Joaquim Silva, and then wins the whole damn thing. Glyco França. It was a weird UFC run that was very short. But when you look at a guy like Joaquim Silva, I say The Ultimate Fighter Season 4 Brazil, that was his springboard into the UFC. Now, the guys that Joaquim Silva's beaten in the UFC, none of them are still around. But you look at the losses, I mean, I guess Jared Gordon is, and he finishes him in the third round in the fight of the night. But Joaquim struggles against the takedowns Vince Pichel. He struggles against the striking of Nasrat Haqparast and then Ricky Glenn. And I went back and watched that Joaquim Silva fight against Ricky Glenn. And then on Sunday, while we're taping these videos, I went up, because it's our mom's birthday, and I said to our stepdad, who does not watch fighting but loves baseball, I said, okay, remember how good Vlad Guerrero was at crow hopping and whipping a ball in from right field? Okay, well, Joaquim Silva's going to do this giant crow hop and get caught by a left hook against Ricky Glenn. And my God, he went, ooh, that's not good. No, it wasn't, because Joaquim loads up on a right hand and jumps into the air to throw the right hand, and he gets caught by a left hook of Ricky Glenn. His last time out against another southpaw, Jesse Ronson, he does end up getting the win. So that is good. Now, again, he breaks that southpaw curse. He had lost to Glenn and Haqparast, who were southpaws. Armin Sarukian, orthodox fighter. He'll mix it up, but he is an orthodox guy. You saw it in the fourth round of his fight against Gamrot, dropped him with that spinning back elbow. And you look at it his last time out for Sarukian. He ends up getting the redemption, the win over Ismagulov, snaps that giant win streak that was almost to 20, and then forced Ismagulov into a portion where he was contemplating retirement.
He was, yeah.
And he had teased it. Now all of a sudden he's got a fight coming up in the not so distant future. Does Demir Ismagulov against American top team's own Grant Dawson. It's a circle jerk of lightweights, Matt, right now. But when you do look at this matchup, again, for Joaquim Silva, a lot of power striking.
It
the
just,
reason
is, could you? I like it this fight, though. Could you imagine if they were like Jared Cannonier's fighting Gerald Meerschaert? It's just weird. You know, it's like a ranked fighter who we expect to not be on a title trajectory, but we fight guys who are in line with title shots, whereas Joaquim Silva can make a fun fight for anybody. He has massive power with his boxing. He does have lethal jiu-jitsu, but he's able to get it in good positions, but he does lack a lot of the in-betweens that we look for when we look at these next-level fighters, and Armin Sarukian does have a lot of those skills.
And we've seen a lot of reaches recently with matchmaking that have gone wild, like Steven Erceg beating David Dvorak. Then you have guys around the fringes, the Jim Miller taking on Jesse Butler. You've also had Jamie Mullerkey taking on Naimov, where it just ends in ways that maybe you didn't think they were going to end. In this matchup, Sarukian is a big favorite. I'm not even going to look at the topology votes for this one. I do have Armand Sarukian.
Yeah.
When you look at it for Silva, he's trained out of Evolução Thai, which big Bruno Silva's trained out of and still does train out of. You also have Neto BJJ, which was the home gym down in Brazil. He did fight his last matchup against Jesse Ronson with Conan Silveira in the corner. So that's why I mentioned ATT quite a bit. You've seen Silva there. It's got to be awkward fighting a teammate or a guy out of the same gym, but I do have Sarukyan in this one.
Yeah, so do I. I think he should be able to win this, and then hopefully they do give him another top 15 matchup, because Lightweight, I know you've said this a few times, Bantamweight's the deepest division. I don't agree. I think Lightweight's still the best division. Everybody in the top 15 could get the belt on any given day. The champion's extremely dominant. Well, I guess he had a close fight with Volkanovski, but the top 25 is very deep. I don't think it's just a, oh, 135's the greatest division going. I think 155 still has something to say about it, but I do have Sarukyan in this fight.
Both of us going with Armin Sarukyan in the matchup, and now it's time for the main event. You have Marvin Vettori taking on Jared Cannonier. You gotta check out that main event video here with Fight Night Picks. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
It's main event time, UFC Vegas 75, Marvin Vettori, the Italian Dream, taking on the Killer Gorilla, Jared Cannonier, as always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP, with me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP, and for both of these guys, former title challengers, as I said, Alex Pereira moving up to 205 to take on Jan Blachowicz, and now all of a sudden, the middleweight division's wide open. Adesanya is your champ. Couple of ranked guys that are taking on unranked guys. You have Sean Strickland and Abus Magomedov.
It's wide open, but isn't it in the same position it's always been? You have Israel number one, Robert Whittaker kind of holding the gate for him number two.
Whittaker doesn't have a fight. I mean, you have Ikram Alaskarov taking on, Paulo Costa. So a lot of opportunity for both these guys to try and knock back on the door of a title shot. And for Vettori, his last time out, kind of a chintzy decision. It was unanimous, but he does get the win over Roman Dolidze. And for Jared Cannonier, you look at it, his was even weirder because the split decision win over Sean Strickland, 49-46 is both way. Sal D'Amato scored at 49-46 for Sean Strickland, which is a wild card.
I had Cannonier, yeah.
And I had Cannonier as well. But if you do look at it for both these guys, fighting a very high level of competition for a really long time, 8 main events between them. And the craziest part about it is Jared Cannonier, 2-0 with the UFC's Apex. Marvin Vettori, 4-0 with the UFC's Apex. Both guys probably going to lose that O, one of those guys is going to lose that O. This fight has a lot of style points on it, but the craziest part about it is for Cannonier against Strickland in a main event, kind of a non-starter. And for Marvin Vettori, like, I think back, okay, what's a similar comp? His fight that he had against Jack Hermanson, which is the UFC's fight that they pushed out there on YouTube, is the free fight. It was fun as it went on, but there were no big knockdowns, there were no big takedowns. There was a lot of volume
dropped him
on the outside. I think this Vettori fight and the Cannonier fight, there's going to be a lot of parallels between the two that I just mentioned.
These guys are oddly similar, but not at all. And let me just at least bring up some of the similarities, at least in their lasting power. Now, they do it in very different ways, because Marvin Vettori is on you for 25 minutes, right? He's in your face. He's going to throw that jab, try to throw the looping right hand, get on the inside, use the clinch to get the takedowns. Whereas Cannonier, he can last, but he's going to have 2 or 3 big flurries in that round and then be a really sound defensive fighter in between. Him and Yoel Romero are not perfect in this respect, but what was Yoel really well known for? He'd hold the hands very high and he'd wait. He'd wait and wait and wait. And what Jared Cannonier does a good job at is, hey, did he lose to Adesanya? Did he lose to Robert Whittaker? Yeah, he did. But other than the one knockdown by Robert Whittaker, for the most part, he's not eating like these crazy big shots, right? He holds his hands up. He's going to wait. And Cannonier does a good job at parrying strikes too. If you're throwing a jab in and you are a little bit lazy with it, he does a great job at throwing it to the side. He can land his own counter shots over the top. And for Cannonier, I think he just follows the game plan that he had against Derek Brunson. You might give up a takedown in the first round.
You might get dropped.
You might get hurt by a shot here or there. Marvin Vettori is capable of all those things. The difference is, Cannonier is going to make Marvin Vettori pay every time he gets close to him. Like, there is a genuine power difference between these two men, because Marvin Vettori is a huge guy, but he's not a huge puncher by any means. And I do think it's part of his style. He's not someone who's going to sit down and throw big winging hooks.
That's it. Marvin Vettori will walk you down. He's really light on his feet, but he never sets into his shots. And maybe that's something that Extreme Couture, that they're working on, it very well could be. But with Vettori, you look at the 5-1 in, the title shot is one of those fights. We go all the way back to the Kevin Holland win that he had. He loses to Israel Adesanya. He beats Paulo Costa in a light heavyweight main event. He loses to Robert Whittaker, and then he goes out there his last time out and beats Roman Dolidze. I thought Dolidze won the first round and the second round based on power alone, but Vettori with his volume was able to get the decision win. It was kind of all over the place, but if you do consider it for Vettori, those two losses, he struggled against the kicks of Robert Whittaker, he struggled against the kicks of Israel Adesanya. Cannonier throws kicks.
Great leg kicks.
Occasionally head kicks, but mostly the leg kicks are the moneymaker for Cannonier. And even if Cannonier gets backed up, he makes you pay on a lot of the shots. The 5-1 in for Cannonier, if I may, it starts with a loss to Robert Whittaker. The kick that broke his arm, that was an issue for him as well. He beats Kelvin Gastelum, the boxer. He beats Derek Brunson, where he gets dropped by a close and tight shot.
Those elbows.
But then those elbows, as I mentioned, in motion, and so did you, that was the lasting factor. Adesanya on the outside was too much. And then the Sean Strickland fight, Cannonier was the one that landed the bigger, heavier power shots, now a training partner of Martin Vettori. And the fight's in the States, so Strickland should be able to be in the corner of this one if he so chooses. You're going to see Nixick there. And maybe there's a chance that we get to see my guy, no sleeve on the right side, Dewey Cooper, cornering. I absolutely love it. But again, we know Cannonier's starting heavyweight, light heavyweight, middleweight, the Goldilocks zone. And if you do consider it, the Gastelum and the Strickland fights were the Cannonier ones in the Apex, where smaller cage, boxers, and Cannonier gets it done. I've tipped my hand. I think Jared Cannonier wins this fight against Marvin Vettori coming up this weekend. I know it's probably not the sexy pick, and we'll get to your YouTube community votes. But when I look at this fight, Matt, for Vettori, if he was settling down on his shots, I think he could mix them in and camouflage them with his volume, and he could get a win against a guy like Cannonier. People will be down on the fact that Cannonier's just a shade over 39. Like, his career brought him to the military before it brought him to fighting, which is wild, and he's had this much success in his second career. Ted started baseball, military, then baseball. But when I look at a fight like this, it should be really close, with a 10-year age gap being what it is.
I agree with you that Cannonier could win this fight. I just think, and this is why I have Martin Vettori, even if he doesn't complete a single takedown and just makes Jared Cannonier defend them for the first 10 minutes of this fight, I think Vettori is going to be able to fight much better as an exhausted version of himself with that higher work rate.
76% of the fans at Fight Night Picks going with Marvin Vettori to get the win. And when you do consider it, I mean, for Vettori, a lot of 5-round experience at this point, and he fought a guy that was somewhat similar to a Jared Cannonier in a Paulo Costa, got the win in that main event, and then we ended up seeing him losing against Robert Whittaker's next time out. Vittori's been in those big fights, so is Jared Cannonier, no stranger from either a main event or an Apex fight, and again, somebody's got to lose the O in the smaller cage. So I do have Cannonier in this fight. I think the kicks are the big difference maker. I think the power shots are going to kind of keep Vettori at bay, and the thing that I liked out of Cannonier is last time out was figuring out the range against a boxer to keep them on their heels and pumping out the jab a little bit more than we've seen. Cannonier was very consistent his last time out, and I actually am going to draw parallels to a prelim fight here. Kyung Ho Gong's last time out against Tanab Bakary, I'm putting too much stock into his volume and his 1-2s. I might be doing the same thing with Jared Cannonier in this matchup, so be forewarned right there. But I think it's going to be overall a big-time fight. Matt, the Diamond Jubilee, 75 events at the Apex, and they're still packing people in like sardines in this one. Martin Vettori choked out Steve. Is it Steve will do it? Over on the Instagram, the Nelk Boy guy. So, yeah, Vettori did that as Michael Bisping did it to Steve-O. I do know Steve-O. I went to see him, and I got his hot sauce. They were good. But, Matt, overall, question mark kicks, that's here on our channel 2 hours before the prelims. You can find us if there's any weird things that happen during the week, any weight misses, we will have you covered on that one on Saturday. There's 14 total fights on this card. That is a lot. So if there's any movement on the card, if anything falls out, we'll update you as soon as possible. I'll be, you know, on the move this week, but we will be sure to get those out as soon as possible. And I know even though there's 14 total fights, we're excited about a lot of the prospects and those fighters, and there are 7 of them that are making their second times out.
Exactly.
That this does feel like a Fight Night Picks type card.
It's a big sophomore dance on this card for some reason. But I think, again, I stress this a lot in the opening. The main event's really important because how many more times is Jared Cannonier at 39 years old could he be able to fight sort of that inner circle of elite middleweight fighters? Because in the top 5, I'd say, in any division, any of those fighters given a good win could fight for the title coming up next. And for Marvin Vettori, the last time out, he kind of faced that, right? If he lost to Roman Dolidze, you're out of that elite pool. So the loser of this is probably going to find themselves on the outside looking in. So I think it is a really important fight.
And I made the mistake earlier, so now I get to follow it up. There is one fight at the top of the middleweight division that's not between these two guys. Robert Whittaker taking on Dricus du Plessis. So that is the other big time one. Strickland versus Magomedov, a main event. Paulo Costa taking on Ikram Aliskerov. You are not going to want to miss the action of this weekend. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.